within a portfolio committee could get that it was important to invite the executive authority to the portfolio committee that we can get the first hand account of the issues. We invited the minister last Tuesday, and a week later we've got the minister here. So that's a very prompt response, and I think it's also very good in terms of accountability that the portfolio committee calls the minister and that he then interrogates the issues at hand. The issue of leadership of IPD is quite important. IPD is an oversight institution. It is made provision for IPD in the constitution. And it's quite critical that there must be confidence by the members of the public and the community at large in the leadership of IPD. Whereas the oversight committee are very much interested to ensure that there is proper management. I think we got a good account from the acting executive director, Mr. Khamanyane, when he appeared before the committee. We believe the developments regarding the suspended executive director, Mr. McBride, and the recent reports, it's important that we as a committee get the full picture and what is the step going forward, as well as if there's a disciplinary process, what are the timelines and so on. So that is really the purpose of today's meeting. We'll give an opportunity to the minister and his team to brief us, and then we'll also give ample opportunity for engagement questions from the members. Welcome to the Honourable Minister of Police, and also to the Acting Secretary of Police, Mr. Nilofwi, and the delegation from the Minister's Office. Welcome to the Portfolio Committee. I think we met in January, at the end of January, when the Minister briefed us on the issue relating to the DBCI, so very much welcome to the Minister. Maybe if we give an opportunity to the Minister, let's ask the Honourable Members just to introduce themselves. We'll start from that side.
And I'm Diane Kerlebarn, I'm also a member. Chair, is your mic on? Is your mic on?
Hello?
There
we are. Yes, Mr. Ramad Lakhan indicated that he is with the Portfolio Committee on Transport, they're dealing with legislation. But I think Ms. Mabija is coming, and I think also Mr. Martin. So there's no, I think, other policies. Thank you very much for that. I will then hand over to the Minister of Police, and if you want to introduce this delegation, you're very much welcome, and then also to continue with the briefing. Thank you.
So thank you very much, Chairperson, honourable members. My name is Paul Nadine, and I work for the South African Police Service. On my right hand is the acting secretary, Mr. Nikofuri. On my left is Mr. Fofini. Sitole is the special advisor to the minister, and on his left is is Mr. Hickson, who is the parliamentary liaison officer. On my I'm not getting paid for it. I'm not getting paid for it. So you must introduce yourself all the way further down there, because I also saw another the police at the back line here also. So it's better that way. Bless. Bless, honey.
I'm not the minister of police.
My name is Sam Orte, parliamentary liaison officer from the Civilian Secretariat for Police.
Major General Mthandazo Mthandazo, the acting head of DPCI.
Mohazo is spokesperson to the minister.
So thank you very much, Chairperson, for welcoming us, but also for granting us this opportunity to come address an account on specific matter relating to the IPD investigations, no, the IPD investigation regarding the legal renditions of the Zimbabwean nationals. Now, why don't I and you to talk to the report as to one institution called the ANPIS regarding the revolving matters. Arising out of that, it became necessary to then establish as to why is it that we had such so-called school reports. And in so doing, we appointed the recommended attorneys, group of attorneys, to conduct further investigations pertaining to this particular matter. We said to them, in formulating the terms of reference, that they needed to establish as to who and under what circumstances was the original report altered, or how the second report came about, with both reports signed by the same person, and in this instance, the C3 investigating officer, Mr. Kuma. The second term of reference was that whether any misconduct or offense has been committed, and if so, by whom. The third area they needed to look into was whether there is prima facie evidence of misconduct and criminal liability by Lieutenant Ramat, Major General Spear, and other officers mentioned in the original report. The fourth area was whether the circumstances under which the report and the docket were handled in the National Prosecuting Authority and what happened to the docket once in the NPA's possession. The fifth area that we wanted the investigation to look into was any other matter that might come to your attention during the investigation with the relevance to conclusions and findings. And based on the evaluation of the first and second reports, as well as the documents and evidence before us, the report is summarized in the sequence of events regarding the renditions as set out below. During the period November 2010 until January 2011, a number of Zimbabwean nationals were arrested by the South African Police Service together with Zimbabwean police officials. The arrest of these individuals was explained by the DPCI in response to a parliamentary question posed by a member of the Congress of the People. The DPCI through Dramat advised Parliament that the individuals in question were deported as illegal immigrants and had been arrested on suspicion of having committed or been involved in certain crimes, such as ATM bombings. The DPCI, in its parliamentary response, further stated that when it came to light that the arrested individuals could not be linked to specific crimes, individuals were deported to Zimbabwe. From the documentation provided for our review, it appears that the DPCI were aware that the response to the parliamentary question was not factually correct. It is our view that they deliberately misled Parliament in this regard. The circumstances surrounding the arrest appeared to be questionable and raised a number of legal considerations relating to, inter alia, lawfulness of the process followed by the South African Police Service in deporting relevant Zimbabwean nationals. The arrest of the five Zimbabwean nationals was effected in three stages, which will be summarized briefly below. The first operation relating to the arrest of Zimbabwean nationals took place on the 5th of November 2010, where four Zimbabwean nationals, namely the signing witness Leia Nelson, Dovuma, Kawis Banda, and Shepard Chuma, were arrested in deep sport and detained him at the Orlando police station in Soweto. The reasons stated for their detention was that they were illegal immigrants. The operation was conducted by the DPCI head office and DPCI provincial office, referred to as Toms. It is alleged that the DPCI and Toms were accompanied by two Zimbabwean police officers. The members of the operation were informed during a parliamentary briefing, stating that they were chasing suspects involved in a robbery committed in Zimbabwe during which a Zimbabwean police superintendent was fatally shot. After the four Zimbabwean nationals referred to in paragraph 2.2.5.11 were booked into Orlando police station. The tiny witness there was booked out of Orlando police station in order to assist the SAPS with the tracing of a certain individual named John. John could not be traced, and the signing witness there was returned to Orlando police station. The four Zimbabwean nationals were detained over the weekend as illegal immigrants, and on the morning of 8 November 2010, they were booked out of Orlando police station by Maluleke. Maluleke indicated at this time that the Zimbabwean nationals were to be transported to Bay Bridge for a peace. Two of the Zimbabwean nationals were released, and the remaining two were transported to Bay Bridge for a post and handed over to a contingent of Zimbabwean police. The circumstances under which the Zimbabwean nationals were deported is circumspect. The locket which was used during the deportation did not belong to the Department of Home Affairs, as it is required in the case of deportations. Although there were documents which were presented as being documents issued under the auspices of the Department of Home Affairs in order to authorize deportation, it appears from analysis of such documentation by an expert in this regard that the documents which purported to be issued by the Department of Home Affairs were forged. Akawe Simanda was later released by Zimbabwean police after allegedly spending 11 days in custody and being tortured. The Misani witness there died while in the custody of the Zimbabwean police. The second operation was conducted on or about the 22nd November 2010 by the same police units which conducted the first operation. In this second operation, Richard Tuma was arrested in Bridgeworth and detained at Alexander Police Station under a Zimbabwean police reference number being Lawayo case number 1337/11 and was booked out on the 23rd November 2010 and taken to Silverton Police Station. It would appear that on the 24th November 2010, warrant officers level of the Gauteng Homes unit of the DPCI on inspection by Malu Lege booked out Richard Tuma from Silverton Police Station and transported him to Bay Bridge for a post accompanied by Malu Lege, where Richard Tuma was handed to the Zimbabwean police. Richard Tuma was never seen again. It is presumed that he also died in Zimbabwe under police custody, the third operation. Malu Lege conducted this part of the operation with the assistance of crime intelligence members of Pretoria. Gordon Dube, a Zimbabwean national, was arrested in conjunction with two other individuals. Dube had a number of criminal cases pending against him. During the arrest, which took place in Pretoria on or about 11th of January 2011, Dube was shot and injured. Due to the fact that Dube was being treated at hospital instead of being held at Witherbrook Police Station, he did not appear in court with the two other individuals who were arrested with him. He was, however, due to appear in court on the 28th of January 2011. He did not appear in court as he was booked out of hospital on Malu Lege's instructions. At the same time, Malu Lege took the gun that was found in Dube's possession when he was arrested from Witherbrook Police Station. The same gun was allegedly used in the robbery in Zimbabwe referred to in paragraph 2.2.5.1.1, which resulted in the death of the Zimbabwean superintendent. Malu Lege informed the investigating officer and Leanne Mayer that Dube would be dealt with through immigration channels. Malu Lege then transported Dube to Bay Bridge and whenever returned to South Africa. Malu Lege once again enlisted the services of crime intelligence in order to trace an additional Zimbabwean national, Johnson Muni. Muni was placed in Bridgeworth and arrested by the crime intelligence members and the TFC unit of the Johannesburg Central Police Station on the 26th January 2011. Muni was taken to the DPCI head office where the members who participated in the arrest of Muni were congratulated by Ramat. Photographs depicting the members involved in the arrest Nyoni, two Zimbabwean police members and their vehicle, and the gun retrieved from Dube's possession were taken by a third Zimbabwean police officer. Nyoni was thereafter booked out on the 28th January 2011 by Malu Lege and taken together with Dube to Bay Bridge Border Post. The entry in the registers at the relevant police station reflect that Nyoni was booked out for the purpose of extradition to Zimbabwe through the Bay Bridge Border Post. Nyoni was killed while in the custody of the Zimbabwean police. Now we come to the issue of the relevant legislation. In conducting our investigation and for the purposes of drawing any legal proceedings, we have considered the following pieces of relevant South African related legislation. The Immigration Act. The deportation of a fugitive must be dealt with in terms of an extradition agreement between South Africa and the country of nationality of the fugitive. If no such extradition agreement exists, and the individual is an illegal immigrant, the Immigration Act applies. In the second instance, there is no extradition agreement between Zimbabwe and South Africa. Notwithstanding that there exists an organization formed in Zimbabwe in order to facilitate international police cooperation, namely Southern African Regional Police Peace Cooperation Organization, this organization does not govern the deportation of Zimbabwean nationals who are illegal immigrants in South Africa. As such, the Immigration Act governs the deportation of Zimbabwean nationals who are illegal immigrants in South Africa. The process which is required to be followed in deporting an illegal immigrant is governed by Section 34 of the Immigration Act, and in terms of the aforementioned section, 34 subsection 1, without the need for a warrant, an immigration officer may arrest any illegal foreigner or cause him or her to be arrested, and shall, irrespective of whether such foreigner is arrested, deport him or her, or cause him or her to be deported, and may, pending his or her deportation, detain him or her, or cause him or her to be detained in a manner and at a place determined by the Director General, provided that the foreigner concerned shall be notified in writing of the decision to deport him or her, and of his or her right to appeal such decision in terms of this. B. May at any time request any officer attending to him or her that his or her detention for the purpose of deportation be confirmed by a warrant of court, which, if not issued within 48 hours of such request, shall cause the immediate release of such foreigner. C. Shall be informed upon arrest or immediately thereafter of the rights set out in the preceding two paragraphs, when possible, practicable, and available in a language that he or she understands. B. May not be held in detention for longer than 30 calendar days without a warrant of a court, which on good and reasonable grounds may extend such detention for an adequate period not exceeding 90 calendar days. And E. Shall be held in detention in compliance with the minimum prescribed standards protecting his or her dignity and relevant human rights, close quote. It is evident from the above that an immigration officer is mandated to follow a particular process when dealing with illegal immigrants. The Immigration Act defines immigration to mean, I quote, an officer appointed by the Director General to perform the functions of either the permitting office, port of entry, or inspector with the contemplated in the Immigration Act, close quote. None of the police officers involved in the rendition are, or were, at the time, immigration officers in terms of the Immigration Act. And as such, none of these persons were legally authorized to conduct a deportation of any Zimbabwean nationals. I would suggest here that page 12 to page 13, perhaps the quotation from the Act in terms of the, I think that quotation in terms of the, what the Immigration Act stipulates as the procedure, but perhaps for purposes of the, perhaps let me see that. The Immigration Act further provides in terms of section 49 that anyone who knowingly assists a person to enter or remain in or depart from the Republic in contravention of this act shall be guilty of an offence and liable on conviction to a fine or to imprisonment not exceeding 5 years. Anyone participating in a conspiracy of two or more persons to conduct an activity intended to contravene this act shall be guilty of an offence and liable on conviction to a fine or to imprisonment not exceeding 7 years, provided that if part of such activity is conducted or intended to be conducted in a foreign country. the offence shall be punishable by imprisonment not exceeding 8 years without the offering of a fine. 8. Anyone who willfully or through gross negligence produces Air Force certification contemplated by this act shall be guilty of offence and liable on conviction to a fine or to imprisonment not exceeding 3 years. 9. Anyone other than a fully authorized party servant who manufactures or provides or causes the manufacturing or provision of a document purporting to be a document issued or administered by the department shall be guilty of an offense and liable on conviction to imprisonment not exceeding 10 years without the option of a fine. It is evident that the procedure to be followed in respect of reporting an illegal immigrant is governed by the Immigration Act. The fact that the Immigration Act was not complied with in Revelation was part of the impetus giving rise to an investigation of the Revelation, which is further evident that a deliberate contravention of the Immigration Act is a crime, subject to the penalties stipulated in the Immigration Act. As already stated above, the Immigration Act was contravened during the rendition. Now, I would also add that the IPIC, citation of the IPIC Act, I skip that particular section on page 13 and 14, but emphasize that from the reading of the IPIC Act and, of course, the stipulated the regulation, it is evident that both criminal and disciplinary recommendations may be named in relation to the conduct of members of SAPS and its directors. This includes the DPCI as a directorate within the South African Police Service. In addition, it appears that in terms of the regulations, the investigator must submit a report on the investigation of the offence to the executive director of IG. I would also, with your permission, Chair, suggest that the relevant kinds and elements of such crimes and the manner in which they are defined on page 15 and 16, I be allowed to skip that up until page 17 of the report, which then itself deals with the methodology in conducting this investigation. In conducting the investigation and preparing this report, we have had access to and have considered the first and second reports, interviewed the following people: Kuba, Mukangwe, Angus, Sisogo, Seng, Zinyat, Baloi, Chauke, Magpain, Chiba. And we have had access to and have considered the documentation listed in Anas attached here too. And for ease of reference, we have divided this report into separate sections as follows. Section A deals with the circumstances surrounding the combining of each report. B, Section B deals with the deletion of evidence from the first report. Section C deals with the analysis and findings, and Section D deals with recommendations. Section A, on the first report, at the outset, it is critical to mention that prior to Kuba conducting any investigations into the rendition, there were two investigations into the rendition that had already been undertaken as follows. The DPCI had conducted and concluded an internal investigation into the rendition, in terms of which the DPCI members involved in the rendition were exonerated from any wrongdoing in the rendition. Two, a member of Crime Intelligence Mukangwe had commenced an investigation into the rendition. According to the investigation conducted under the auspices of Crime Intelligence, was never concluded. Instead, it was done jointly with IP. The first report was combined by Nkuba with the assistance of Mukangwe and the guidance of Mosing and Mueleji. In this section, we elucidate the circumstances under which this report was produced by Nkuba and Mukangwe. Our explanation of the circumstances under which this report was produced is based on the interviews conducted with Nkuba, Mukangwe and Mosing. It is important to state that the Special Projects Division in the Office of the NDPP was tasked to provide guidance to Kuba and Mukangwe during the course of their investigation. The Special Projects Division is headed by Musing, assisted by Mueleji. The role of Musing and Mueleji was never to make a decision on whether to prosecute or not. On the 23rd October 2012, Kuba received a docket from Sissoko, and an appointment letter to conduct an investigation of all cases of alleged assault in relation to Sibiya. Upon perusal of the docket of this was 390/07/2012, it discovered that the DPCI had received the complaints relating to the narration. In light of the above, Kuba was instructed by the former acting executive director of IPIT, Kubi Mbeyi, to conduct an investigation into the narration. He was further instructed to liaise with Mukangu so that the latter could assist him to conduct investigation. Kuba briefed Mukangu on the intended investigation, and it was agreed that Mukangu will assist Kuba in conducting the investigation into the narration. What was further agreed was that Mukangu's name would not appear in the report once the investigation is finalized, as the investigation was commissioned by IPIT and Mukangu was employed at Crime Intelligence. Kuba began his investigation by interviewing certain members of the Department of Home Affairs. At this stage, the docket already had statements obtained from the Towns, Crime Intelligence, and the Zimbabwe nationals who had been subject to the violation. Subsequently, on the 7th of March 2013, Kuba visited the office of Ramaz. Mukangu was a party to this meeting as well. At this meeting, Ramaz stated that he did not recall meeting with the Zimbabwean police. Kuba requested certain documents, including statements and documents related to the internal investigation into the rendition conducted by DPCI from Ramaz. Ramaz instructed Kuba that such request be made in writing. When Kuba was finally provided with the requested documents, it appeared as if the statements provided recorded that the internal investigation conducted by DPCI was conducted properly and that everything was in order. Kuba, however, was unconvinced as to the correctness of the statement of a particular individual being Madilonga, which statement was signed but not commissioned. Kuba met with Madilonga, who provided a news statement detailing the actual events regarding his involvement in the revolution. Excuse me. Kuba conducted further investigations relating to the passage of individuals through the Great Bridge border post on the dates relevant to the nation. In addition, Kuba spoke to Leonie Fester, who was Maluleke's supervisor. Leonie Fester indicated that Maluleke did not respect the chain of command and would communicate directly with Sibiya. Leonie Fester also drew Kuba's attention to the success reports directed from us, Lydia, Sanchoayo, and others. Kuba perused the three success reports with which he had been provided and noted that one report dealt with the deportation or the arrest of Ndea and others that were connected relating to the murder of a Zimbabwe police officer in Zimbabwe. One success report recorded that the Zimbabwe police came and met with Ramaz on the 5th November 2010 and requested assistance. The success report further recorded Maluleke's appointment to head the assignment chase with the Zimbabwean fugitives. Kuba obtained the laptop belonging to Maluleke and found that the success reports were generated from this laptop. The laptop also contained photographs of the operation as well as correspondence to Zimbabwean police officers. Kuba's investigation continued. As part of the investigation, Kuba met with members of Crime Intelligence. At their offices, Kuba noticed that the photographs which he obtained from Maluleke's laptop relating to the operation were posted on the office walls of some members of Crime Intelligence. Kuba was informed by a member of Crime Intelligence who considered that during January 2011, when the arrests were completed, he went to the DPCI's offices and Ramaz personally came to the offices at house number 3 and congratulated them for a job well done. According to Mukashibe, Ramaz requested that they not tell anyone about the details of the operation. According to Kuba, Mukashibe confirmed that he has a historical relationship with Ramaz due to their mutual involvement in Mkhondo Wesizwe. Mukashibe's statement was corroborated by Ngwenya, who confirmed that Dramat addressed the officers and congratulated them. However, Ngwenya did not mention Dramat, telling them not to divulge the details of the operation. In addition, a head officer, Mokobu, stated that she was out of the office at the time that Dramat attended to congratulate him. However, upon her return, she was informed that Dramat was congratulating the officers at House No. 3. Subsequently, there was a leak of information regarding the investigation which was published in Sunday Times. At this time, Kumail Mohsin began asking questions to Dramat inquiring about Dramat's involvement in the rendition. Kuba also interviewed Malulege specifically regarding his promotion from kitchen to kennel. Kuba was not successful in obtaining the files regarding Malulege's promotion. Kuba records that Dramat sent a report in response to the parliamentary question posed by a member of the Congress of People of the People regarding the rendition, explaining the circumstances of the rendition by stating that the Zimbabwean nationals were reported as illegal immigrants. This caused Kuba to investigate the matter further. He considered the expense claims relating to the travelling to Beirut border post, as well as cell phone and vehicle tracker records positioning Malulege Makuwe, Ngosi and Constable Sadeva at its work on the night of the arrest. Kuba then investigated the booking in and out of certain police stations of the relevant Zimbabwean nationals following the arrest at Discord. Kuba then began finalizing the report, but did so in the absence of an analysis of the cell phone records of Sibir. Although Kuba was in possession of cell phone records in relation to Sibir, such cell phone records had to be interpreted by an expert. According to Kuba, as he was conducting an investigation with Mukangwe, they would consult with Mohsin and Welitsi, who were providing guidance in the process of gathering the evidence to be collected and finalized in the investigation. At some stage during 2013, Mohsin and Welitsi advised Kuba and Mukangwe as to which information in their draft report dated October 2013 needed to be added. This information was the warning statements from Dramat, Spear, Malulege, Leon Fester, and analysis of cell phone records by an expert. Kuba advised that subsequent to the advice by Mohsin and Moelison, he and Mukanga conducted further investigations to address the concerns raised by Mohsin and Moelison. According to Kuba, all the individuals mentioned above refused to provide warning statements. In light of that, which is stated in the preceding paragraph, Kuba and Mukwano finalized their investigation and provided a report with recommendations. This report was submitted to Mohsin and Moelitsi on the 22nd January 2014. This report, being the first report, was in the opinion of Mukwano and Kuba final. The recommendations made to this report were that Dramat, Spear, Malulege, Makoe, Hadebe, and Nkosi be criminally charged with defeating the ends of justice and kidnapping. According to Kuba, the first report was submitted as a final report, and they expected the National Prosecuting Authority to take further action as required by law on the basis of their recommendations set out today. In our interview with Mukangwe, Mukangwe corroborated Kuba's version regarding his involvement in the investigation and the compilation of the first report. Mukangwe explained why he, as a member of SADS, was tasked with conducting an investigation on behalf of Anki. In this regard, he stated that the majority of the work had already been done by crime intelligence and that his superiors were of the view that he should assist Kuba in finalizing the investigation. According to Mukangwe, when they, in other words, Mukangwe and Kuba, finalized the first report on 22nd January 2014, the only outstanding information was warning statements from Dramat, Spear, Fester, and Malulege, who had all refused to provide these warning statements. Mukangwe corroborated Kuba's testimony that Dramat, Spear, and Malulege had refused to provide warning statements when they were approached, them testimony to the advice of Mohsin and Moelitsi. Dramat told them that he wants to involve his attorney and would only give a statement after discussing the same with his attorney. Sibiya requested that he sent questions and would thereafter respond to such questions. when they refuse and advise them that he will answer all the questions in court. Pasteur, who in their view was quite knowledgeable on the operation, was also refusing to provide him with a statement. According to Mukamwe, this was the only outstanding information in the first report, and that in their view, nothing further could be done to obtain this information. As such, the first report was not contemplated to be the subject to any further amendment or revision. Mukwang went on to say that the report on the 22nd January 2014 was final and they could not force anyone to make statements or give evidence. Mukwang informed us that he does not know anything about the second report and was not involved in the drafting of the third report. Mosin collaborated Kuba and Mukwang's evidence in relation to the involvement of his office in the investigation into religion. Mosin explained that the preliminary report was prepared on the 22nd October 2013, compiled by Kuba and Mukwang, and was presented to Mosin and Mueleji for consideration. This was the draft report. Mosin and Mueleji advised Kuba and Mukwang to conduct further investigations. On 12th November 2013, Mosin addressed an NPA internal memorandum to Masana and Jiba, updating them on the status of the investigation conducted by IPA. Mosin attached the preliminary report to this memorandum. In this memorandum, Mosin inter alia summarized the evidence gathered at that stage and stressed the need for further investigation to be conducted in relation to certain aspects of the investigation as per paragraph 5.6 of the preliminary report. We are not able to confirm as to whether or not Nathan had ever received a copy of the internal memorandum mentioned at 3.1.130 as he has failed to respond to our request to meet. Paragraph 4 of Mosin's memorandum specifies the outstanding investigations required at that stage to analyze the report. This includes the reports of analysis of cell phone records, the reports on analysis of vehicle tracking information of the members involved during the operations, and the statements from Vance Via in Mandela. Kuba and Mukwang continued with their investigation and requested warning statements from the above individuals, all of which refused to provide warning statements. The investigator thereafter obtained the analysis of cell phone records and finalized their reports. On the 22nd January 2014, Kuba met with Mosin and Mueleji to submit the report as a final report. According to Mosin, Kuba and Mukwang felt that they had now completed their work and that it was up to Masana to make a decision on the merits of the case. Mosin advised Kuba to include his statement that the investigator in order to explain how he conducted the investigation. This was the only outstanding statement in the report of the 22nd January 2014. Mosin further advised that further advised us that 2 days after 22nd January 2014, Kuba included his statement into the report and subsequently signed the same. Kuba did not change the date of the report to signal the exact date that the report was signed. The first report was complete and submitted to Mosin for further action. On 18 February 2014, Mosin addressed an internal memorandum to Jiba and Chaupe, indicating that the investigations had been finalized and that a report from IPIT has been submitted for the purposes of considering the merits of the case. The first report was attached to this memorandum. Mosin further stated that the docket compromising of two Labour Act files together with other files containing cell phone data and evidence obtained from a computer belonging to the DCI was also included. She confirmed that the internal memorandum was drafted on her advice and she confirmed the receipt of both internal memorandums, being the memorandums mentioned at 3.1.30 and 3.1.36 from Mosin. After the report was sent to Chauke, Chauke handed the docket to Advocate Fanzai. On 7th March 2014, Kuba, accompanied by Angus, removed the docket from the possession of Advocate Conway. The first report contains in alia a summary of the material statements provided by the individuals interviewed during the investigation as well as an analysis of the evidence. The first report recommends that Ramash B. Amalule, Hadebe Nkosi and Makuwe be prosecuted for their involvement in the rendition, specifically in relation to the crimes of kidnapping and defeating the ends of justice. The report further recommends that Malule, Hadebe Nkosi and Makuwe be prosecuted for assault and theft. The second report, how the second report was combined. Subsequent to the submission of the first report on the 8th of March 2014, McBride was appointed as Executive Director of IP. At this stage, McBride requested an update of all the high-profile matters that were being handled by IP, including the rendition. As such, after McBride was appointed, Sisogo, McBride and Kuba began working on the second report. This was done in the absence of any consultations in this regard with Mukange and Omusing, who were both active in the investigation and the submission of the final report, of the first report, sorry.
Sorry, Mr. Hostages, this from the EPA?
Yes. In absence, we believe that it is important for us to note that although we make reference to the so-called second report, we also view that this term is a misnomer. The second report is not an additional report in the matter of the rendition, nor does it appear to be an update of the first report as implied by Kuba. It is clear upon perusal of the first and second reports that the second report is actually a version of the first report which has been altered by the deletion of certain evidence in order to arrive at a conclusion which is far more removed from the conclusion of the first report. There appears to be no valid explanation for this deletion of evidence. Nor are we able to ascertain who is responsible for such deletions. Even after having interviewed each of Kuba, Sisogo and O'Brien to bring the whole signatures to the second report. The first report was drafted and submitted as set out in section A1. As mentioned previously, the second report differs from the first report in respect of the recommendations made by each report and the summary of evidence contained in each report. While the first report was signed by Kuba, the second report was signed by Kuba, McBride and Sisogo. It is the version of Kuba that the submission of the second report was necessitated by two things, namely, the addition of new evidence and as a result of discussions with Sisogo. Both Mukange and Musing confirmed that even though they were part of the investigation team in respect to the submission of the first report, they were not consulted in the decision to amend the findings and recommendation of the first report, which subsequently resulted in the drafting of the second report. The sequence of events which led to the issuing of a second report are suspicious, insofar as the dramatic change in the conclusion and recommendations of each report does not appear to have been occasioned by a substantial addition to the evidence, but instead seems to be occasioned by a deletion of evidence. Kuba states that he met with McBride in order to discuss his investigation. However, prior to meeting with McBride, Kuba provided Sisogo with an email copy of his report to pass along to McBride so that McBride would be able to prepare for a meeting with Kuba. Although Sisogo confirms the receipt of such email from Kuba, he is unclear of whether he provided McBride with a hard copy or a soft copy of the report. Notwithstanding that Kuba states that he emailed a copy of the first report to Sisogo for McBride's attention, and Sisogo confirms that he provided the reports to McBride. Both Sisogo and McBride are adamant in stating that they did not have knowledge of the first report. This version by McBride is contradicted by Kuba, who states that in his first meeting with McBride, it was evident from a discussion regarding the rendition that McBride had regard to the first report. According to Kuba, on the 5th of March 2014, McBride met with Kuba. It was evident from the discussions held between Kuba and McBride during this meeting that McBride had regard to the first report. Subsequently, Kuba briefed Sisogo on the matter. The following day, being the 6th of March, Kuba permit with Mapai, Sisowe and Angus. It is alleged that Mapai requested Angus to review the process of the investigation to ensure that the investigation had been conducted appropriately. Angus, however, advised Mapai that he did not believe that it was appropriate for him to get involved at that stage of the investigation. It was on this day that Mapai requested Kuba to retrieve the documents from the NTA and to provide Mapai with every document Kuba possessed regarding this matter. On the 7th of March 2015, Kuba attended at the offices of the DPP with Angus and specifically advocate, who was in possession of the docket at the time. Kuba and Angus then removed the docket from the possession of advocate Fanzai. During our interview with Angus, he failed to disclose the fact that he attended at the office of the NTA with Kuba in order to retrieve the docket. When this issue was subsequently raised with him, Angus states that he merely signed for the docket in the capacity of witness, but he was allegedly not aware of the fact that he was signing for the removal of the docket. This is directly contradicted by Kuba, who states that Angus was aware of the request by Mapai for the docket to be moved, for the docket to be moved, excuse me. Attended at the NTA and spoke with Advocate Fonseca directly requesting the docket. The first draft of the second report went to and fro amongst the Kuba and Sisowo and Mapai. Kuba states that at no stage did Mapai request that Kuba exonerate any particular individual in the report. Kuba states that he signed the last page of the second report once it was finalized and did not initiate each page. As such, he would be incapable of knowing if any information was added or removed. The second report was then submitted and dated the 18th of March 2014. During our interview with Kuba, his attention was on to the discrepancies between the recommendation of the first report and the second report. Kuba's initial explanation for certain deletions was related to the fact that an evaluation of the evidence in relation to Sibiya and in conjunction with his discussions with Sisowo, it was decided that it would not be possible to prove that Sibiya was guilty of assault beyond a reasonable doubt. Kuba later stated that he is strongly concerned about the removal of certain information, specifically the deletion of evidence which implicates fraud. He states that the second report only went through three hands, being the three co-signatories to the report, including himself, and that all he did in respect of the report was to add information which was outstanding at the time. Kuba is not able to adequately address the issue as to why the recommendation in respect of grammar was changed when initially the recommendation in the first report was based on grammar's knowledge of the events and not his physical participation. Kuba stressed that if there were changes to the first report, he had no way of knowing if the second report reflected such changes. According to Kuba, he did not check whether the final version of the report was the same document that he emailed to Sisowo. Furthermore, according to Kuba, he signed the second report and provided it to the other two co-signatures for signature, after which he cannot advise as to how the report was presented to the National Prosecuting Authority. McBride's version is that the only input he had into the second report related to grammatical changes made by McBride, and that he did not see the first report, nor did he make substantive changes. This version is contradicted by Kuba, who states that McBride had seen the first report and had given input into the report which was not just grammatical. According to Mapai, he was provided with the second report which was already signed by both Kuba and Sisowo. As stated above, Sisowo alleges that he never had regard to the first report and was not responsible for the deletion of evidence. As will be further elucidated in section B below, the first report and second report differ in a number of aspects. In summary, The most dramatic difference between the two reports are the difference between the recommendations contained in each report. While the first report recommends that Ramachi, Manulenga, Hadele, Posi, and Makua be charged criminally for their participation in the litigation, the second report recommends that only Manulenga be charged criminally for his participation in the litigation. While the second report contains summaries of the statements given by the relevant individuals whose statements they summarize in the first report, but for the addition of the statements, but for the addition of statements from Donald Spearman, Malulege, and Jennifer Iris Kobusiani, the manner in which certain statements are summarized in the second report has been changed insofar as the portions of certain statements and all evidence and even the analysis of findings which are reflected in the first report have been altered to remove wording which implicates the matter having knowledge of the rendition. Although Kuba states that one of the reasons for the necessity of drafting the second report is the addition of new evidence, it is clear from an analysis of both reports that the only addition to the second report relates to the addition to the statements mentioned above and the addition of the analysis of Ramach's cell phone records. Other than the above, nothing additional was added. More importantly, as noted above, is that certain material portions of the individual statements found in the first report have been removed from the second report. Pertinent information relating to the analysis of cell phone records has been removed, and the records have been analyzed in a way which falls short of the scrutiny contained in the first report and which is required in the investigation process. How the docket was dealt with after the submission of the second report is now the consideration of this report. On the 18th of June 2014, Advocate Fandey requested the docket from Kuba telephonically. Kuba's response was that McBride had instructed him to return the docket to the National Director of Public Prosecution, and that this had been done. Chaule addressed a letter on the 3rd of July 2014 to Nasana informing him about the above sequence of events regarding the docket. The National Director of Public Prosecution responded to the letter on 20th August 2014, indicating that the NDPP is in the process of considering the matter and that Advocate Hauke may close his fund. In December 2014, after the suspicion of Ramach, according to Hauke, he received a call from the NDPP inquiring about the rendition matter and was informed that Ramach had been suspended. The NDPP requested Chauke to proceed with dealing with the matter. Chauke advised the NDPP that he had since closed the file on the matter and was not dealing with it anymore. Subsequently, on or about January 2015, the NDPP contacted Nzinyati and advised Nzinyati that the NDPP had received the docket from Chauke and that the matter fell under Nzinyati's jurisdiction because it was wherein the arrests of the Zimbabwean nationals took place fell under the jurisdiction of the North Gauteng DPP. According to McBride, it was IPIC and not Chauke that took the docket to the NDPP after McBride had signed the second report on the 9th of April 2014. Shortly after his return from leave, on the 13th January 2015, Zimbabwe was furnished with the docket by the NDPP. At the time, this word did not fall under the jurisdiction of Nzinyati, which the NDPP was aware of. As such, this referring of the docket by the NDPP to Nzinyati amounted to a transfer of jurisdiction in terms of Section 2, Subsection 3 of the National Prosecution Authority Act from one DPP to another DPP. Nzinyati, together with Baloyi, produced the docket and engaged in discussions amongst themselves. In addition, Baloyi engaged in discussions with Kuba. Nzinyati and Baloyi issued their recommendation in respect of this matter on the 13th of March 2015. In light of the transfer of jurisdiction mentions X 3.2.2.5, the recommendation made by Nzinyati was a decision. A decision as to whether or not the process taken by the EPP is subject to review only by the NDPP in terms of section 22 subsection 2C of the NPA Act. There is no authority in the National Prosecuting Authority Act which allows a DPP to review a decision taken by another DPP. Subsequently, on 1st April 2014, Chauke received the docket from the NDPP with a letter containing Zinyasi's recommendations and was requested to make a decision on Zinyasi. This amounts to a review of the decision taken by Zinyasi, which is contrary to provisions of section 22 subsection 2C of the NPA Act. Now comes to section B, deletion of evidence from the first report. The column on the left is report 1, the column on the right is report 2. On page 9, on the statement from Dan Delaney Richard Malonga, on report 1, it states that the statement of Malonga states as follows in relevant paragraphs. I quote, Superintendent Mube told him that he was going to Pretoria to meet General Dramat. He said to him that he knew about the chief superintendent who had been murdered. He said that the suspects were in housing and he had organized the General Dramat to assist him in placing the suspects. Also. On IPIP report 2, on the same statement, Superintendent Mube told him that he was going to Pretoria to meet General Dramat. He said to him that maybe he knew about the chief superintendent who had been murdered. He said that the suspects were in Kaugain and he had organized the General Dramat to assist them in chasing the suspects. On report 1, Madilonga states that he will state that he told Superintendent Mube that he had to verify with his seniors about the arrangements. He was given a number of General Dramat by Superintendent Mube. He called Colonel Razlan to verify the information, but she requested that he should call Brigadier Makushu, who was a provincial head of protection and security services. He then called him on his cell phone and explained to him that they are police from Zimbabwe who are intending to have a meeting with General Dramat. Brigadier Makushu told him that he was not aware of the visit, but if the people are saying that they are going to meet with the general, he should call General Dramat directly. He phoned General Dramat on his cell phone, and he responded by saying that he is aware of the Zimbabwean police and he must let them come. That's on report 1. On report 2, the paragraph that follows the above preceding paragraph has been deleted. For periods of 2 weeks, this is now what Madilonga is supposedly saying, I quote this one, for a period of 2 weeks, he never had anything from Superintendent Mube and his group, after 2 weeks he received a call from Superintendent Mube who told him that he was in town and he wanted to say to God. He went to town and met with them in front of Top Sporting Store. They bought liquor and they left to the border. He did not escort them. They went to the border and crossed to Zimbabwe close to. The paragraph that begins with he will state from first report is deleted in the second report. On the first report, the relevant paragraph to the success report reads as follows. The report, I quote, the report bears a reference 14/02/01 and was signed by Colonel Leone Fester. Paragraph A1 of the report states that on 5th November 2010, General Dramat held a meeting with Zimbabwean police at DCI offices about the nationals who shot and killed one of their senior officers. Paragraph 3 states that Etel Maldeve was tasked to trace and arrest the said nationals. The report also covers the arrest of Gordon Mube and an affiliation of TRT members of crime intelligence, close quote. On report 2, in this report, this is what is deleted. The paragraph beginning with the court base of Athletics Sporting /02/01 from the first report is deleted in the second report. On paragraph on report one, the quoted email states the following. He sent emails circulating more than 20 photos of both the suspects arrested and the members involved in the operation. The emails were sent to the DA of Ramat Kumla, Zimbabwean police, and members of crime intelligence. Close quote. The same paragraph on report two in this report does not mention all the individuals to which the emails were sent to. It reads as follows. I quote, he sent emails circulating more than 20 photos of both the suspects arrested and the members involved in the operation. He sent emails to Zimbabwean police trying to find out how they traveled back home and that he is still chasing the remaining suspects. Page 22, on the first report, a letter to stakeholders dated the 20th of August 2020, the said letter states thus, I quote, the letter was generated the same day indicating that in August 2010, General Spear and General Bramant went to Zimbabwe to discuss matters of cooperation on cross-border crimes. General Spear was appointed as the coordinator of the cooperation issue between the two countries. Other letters about the arrest of Zimbabwean nationals in connection with the murder of Zimbabwean police refers to the cooperation agreed during the same meeting. Page 21 of the second report, a letter to stakeholders. In this report, the names of the people involved in the cooperation with the Zimbabwean police are no longer mentioned. The letter reached us in the report. I quote, the letter was generated the same day indicating the trip to Zimbabwe to discuss matters of cooperation on cross-border crimes. Close quote. Page 22 of the first report on documents regarding Moyo's case. Towards the end of this paragraph, Malule stated the following in the letter. In a letter written to General Ramat, he stated that he went to Zimbabwe and conducted an operation with the Zimbabwe police at Moyo's home village on the 5th of November 2011. Moyo was subsequently shot at, transported to the border with the help of Zimbabwean police. Close quote. Page 21 of the second report regarding documents regarding Moyo's case, the letter referred to by Mulele does not disclose to whom the letter was addressed. In this report, this is what he states. In a letter, he states that he went to Zimbabwe and conducted an operation with Zimbabwean police at Moyo's home village on the 5th of November, 2011. Close quote. Page 23, regarding evidence in terms of Section 205 of CPA in 51 of 1977, evidence of CBR's cell records show that he communicates with officers involved, including Ramat. The analysis is put to us. I quote, upon perusal of the cell phone records, it was discovered that Major General Spear communicated with officers who were involved in the operation. For an example, Captain Madlere and sent more than 20 SMSs to Major General Thomas. However, Major General Thomas never responded to the SMS. The same automated SMS were sent to Lieutenant General Bia. These SMSs were sent at various milestones of the operation as deduced from the witnesses' statements and documentary proof. Report 2 on page 23, evidence in terms of Section 205 of CPA 51 of 1977. The analysis of Sibir's cell phone records now only analyzes Sibir's presence at the time scene, not communicating with the officers as well. The analysis is as follows in this report. I quote findings. Major General Spear was never at the crime scenes or planning area as arrested by members of crime intelligence. Those quotes. the same page, page 33, drama cinema phone records are not scrutinized or not mentioned in this report. On the report 2, according to this report, drama entire cell phone records does not show any interaction between him and the Zimbabwean police. The findings are formulated as, I quote, the entire cell phone record of Lieutenant General Drama does show any interaction with the Zimbabwean counterparts. However, the fact that Zimbabwean police might have entered the country is confirmed by photographs, but there is no evidence that they were with Lieutenant General Drama. The photos show them with members of the deputy, Captain Malule, and members of Prime Intelligence close folks. The cell phone records, the report one, the cell phone records of Malulege are analyzed in the following manner. The interaction between Major General Sibiya and Captain Malulege was also found in the form of receipt and outgoing calls. Captain Malulege also communicated with General Dramat in terms of outgoing SMSs at very important milestone of the operation. However, General Dramat never responded to the SMS, which he received from Captain Malulege at 23:12:15 on the 5th of November 2010. Now, that point is captured as follows on report 2, that there is no analysis of Malulege's cell phone records, only that there is prima facie case against him. The report 1, on the same page, the cellular phone records of Colonel Nipping are analyzed thus in this report. Cell phone records of Lieutenant General Nipping, he was directly reporting to Major General Spear. He contacted General Spear telephonically, and in his statement, he stated that he believed he reported the operation to Major General Spear close quote. On report 2, there is no mention of this information and statement by Nipping in report 2. On the same page, the telephone call made by Mike Longer to Dramat, I quote, cell phone records of Lieutenant Colonel Mike Longer. He is a police officer who was posted at the border during the operation. He assisted Captain Malulege to cross the border with the suspects. He contacted Lieutenant General Dramat when he welcomed the Zimbabwean police the first time. His cell phone records, his interaction with Captain Malulege in line with his statement. Report 2 on the same issue. The report only checks the basis of Madilonga making contact with Malulege. The version by Madilonga in the first report that he conducted dramatically obliterated and not discussed in the analysis. Page 24 on report 1, cellular phone records on both Singapore and Hadley, but this report does not contain the cellular phone records of these employees. On the same page, page 24, on report 2, on the cell phone records of both in Makue and the Hadebe. This report contains the cell phone records of the above employees. Then I quote, the report confirms that they were at the scene, even though the allegation of theft is not corroborated. A statement by Kuba on the same page explaining his findings. His findings, the relevant deleted paragraph in the second report is the following, I quote, on 28 January 2013, he was called by the former executive director who gave him the following documents stating that she received them from the city police. Report on illegal donations dated the 25th June 2012, accompanied by warrants of detention B1-1725. For the following, the Mutani witness there, Shepherd Tuma, Nelson Blue, and three notification of the deportation of an illegal foreigner, DNA-1689 for Nelson Blue, Shepherd Tuma, and Makawis Banda. The documents are filed in the docket SK836, and a last copy of the certificate was made from a copy of Sunday Times newspaper. They received from Brigadier Zangwa dated 23rd October 2011, titled, quote unquote, James to death in an unmarked car, and is fined as the 8th advice. On the analysis and findings of the same report, report one, of dramatically cell phone reports is recorded by Kuba Estates. Evaluation of the above findings in the entire cell phone records of Lieutenant General Dramat requested for the period 20 October 2010 to 28 February 2011, the number 01553463000 only appears once, which rules out any form of communication before the 4th of November 2010 and after the first date. This supports his version that he called Lieutenant General Dramat in connection with the Zimbabwean police. On the second report on the same issue, nothing is said about this issue. On the question of, in the first report, on the question of the Dramat held a meeting on the 5th of November 2010 with Zimbabwean police planning the operation, Kuba finds the following in this respect. I quote, evaluation of the above findings. The success report signed by Leonie Presser was traced to Lieutenant Colonel Malmele's laptop stick from the retrieved deleted data. The report was amended on 26 January 2011 and 31st, I think there's a typo there in terms of the date, before it could be emailed to a female officer, warrant officer Tabitha Mokanta, on 9 February 2011 at 40:32. There is no material difference between the document retrieved from the laptop and that found at the Hawks offices during investigation. This proves that Leonie Pester did not generate success report, but only signed the report after by Captain Mandela, the date of the meeting between Zimbabwe police and General Dramat, which took place on the 3rd of November 2010, coincided with the date of the 4th of November 2010, which, according to cell phone records, General Dramat was called at 20:56 by Lieutenant Colonel Madilonga seeking permission to allow Zimbabwean police to enter into the country. Since the Zimbabwean police were at Beirut between 2000 hours and 2100 hours, it is logical that they arrived in Gauteng late at night, leaving them with the opportunity to have the meeting with General Dramat in the morning of the 5th of November 2010, as stated in the success report. Close quote. On the same issue, Kuba states the following in respect of the allegation in this report. The success, I quote, the success report that claimed that Lieutenant General Dramat had a meeting with the Zimbabwean police lacks detail about the meeting itself. There is no indication of what was discussed and who was part of the meeting. It is on that basis that a prima facie case cannot be premised on speculation but need corroborated facts. Close quote. On the commission of government resources into the operation, Kuba states on report one makes the following finding. Evaluation of the above findings. Despite the fact that General Dramat, as an accounting officer, did not sign any claim of Captain Mandela delegating responsibility to Major General Sina to assist the Zimbabwean police in facing and a suspect invariably commit government resources in an unlawful operation that amounts to a criminal offense. Close quote. On the same issue, on report two, nothing is said of this aspect. On congratulating report one, on congratulating the officers for the arrest of John Yoni, Kuba makes the following finding in this regard. I quote, evaluation of the above findings, words of appreciation from General Dramat show both interest in the arrest of the Zimbabwean nationals and his knowledge of the operation. If the operation was lawful, he would not have warned them not to tell anyone about it. Close quote. On the same heading in report two, nothing is said about this issue. On report one, same page, appropriate communication regarding success reports and photos of the operation through his PA, personal assistant formula. I quote, according to the information retrieved from the sales chief of the laptop, Katie Manulega sent him many speculating more than 20 photos of both the suspects arrested and the members involved in the operation. The emails were sent to the PA of General Dramas, former Zimbabwean police, and members of crime intelligence, close quote. On the second report, that being said about this issue. On the third report, he was kept informed of the developments in the operations that led the arrest of one Zimbabwean nationals. I quote, the cell phone records of General Smear showed 80 SMS he sent to General Damas, various milestones of the operation. He also received an SMS from Casey Mandela shortly after the arrest of Zimbabwean nationals. He never responded to any of the SMSs, which may suggest that they were only informing him of the progress. To report two, nothing said about this particular matter. The report to Parliament in response to the allegation on report one, I quote, a copy of the letter sent by Zimbabwean authorities to Colonel Ndendeni clearly mentioned the names of people whom General Dramati in his report to Parliament stated that they were deported for being illegal immigrants. The letter clearly indicates that the suspects were wanted for murdering Superintendent Satikobo of Bulawayo on the 18th of September 2010. It goes further to state that there was a joint operation between South African police and the Zimbabwean police to face and arrest the suspects. On the second report, nothing is said of this point. In the first report, it's an focus findings on Sibiya page 32. The meeting held between IDG and Ramat on the 7th of March 2013, I quote, there is evidence and witnesses corroborate each other that General Spear was both at the same and planning venue. The meeting held between ISIS and General Ramat on, again, another type of day, that 20th, so, I think we'll have to correct, confirmed that General Spear was appointed to be head of phones, which he created to trace other suspects, close quote. Nothing is also said about that particular point on report two. On report one, a severe presence at the scene, I quote, witness stated that he was seen during the operation that took place on the 22nd November 2010, which led to the arrest of Richard Kuma, close quote. On report two, nothing is said about that point. The federal records analysis on page 1, I quote, in other operations, cell phone record of Warrant Officer Mabuwe, Captain Malulege and Colonel Nitin, they show continuous contacts with General Sibiya during and shortly after the operation. Colonel Nitin also stated that he should have reported progress to General Sibiya during the operation. However, the cell phone records of General Sibiya does not fit in the scenes and planning venues as claimed by witnesses. It is also clear that some of the witnesses claim to have heard that General Sibiya was in the car rather than seeing him personally. Close quote. On the second report, nothing is also said about this point. On the first report on the...
I'm sorry, Minister. We go just to allow him this 5 minutes comfort break and see him more when we come back. 5 minutes. Thank you, Minister.
No, I think.
oh, you know, which is the guy, you know, he's killed. And the one that this guy has, of course, I mean, he has to be a murderer.
Thank you. the numbers. It's in
apologies about the venue, but that was when the venue was allocated to us. Members, may I just indicate, the ministry will provide us also with copies. They are just going to the office to provide us with copies. But let's continue, and we'll just allow the members to join us.
Okay, good. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you. Constable T.M. Hadebe and Captain S. Ingalls.
on the same subject matter on recommendations, report 2 states, I quote, based on the available evidence, the independent police investigative director recommends that no charges should be brought against the Lieutenant General Ramat and Major General Steer. The investigation established that there is no prima facie case against them. However, with regard to Lieutenant Colonel Emma Luleya, there is a prima facie case to sustain charges of kidnapping and defeating the ends of justice, close quote. Section C on the analysis and findings. For ease of reference, in dealing with our analysis and findings, we will address each question posed in our table of reference separately below. We will make a recommendation in the context of an examination of the responses to each of the questions. First question, who and under what circumstances was the original report authored and or how the second report came about, with both reports signed by the same person, i.e. Kuba, Mr. Kuba, sorry. Necessity of drafting the second report. The first report was drafted and signed by Kuba in the circumstances set out at section A1. The second report was drafted in the circumstances set out at A2 and signed by Kuba, Sisogo, and Magdalene. Kuba was the lead investigator in the engagement. He was assisted in conducting his investigation by Mukangwe. During the investigation process, Kuba liaised with Musing and Mueleti from the National Prosecuting Authority. Musing confirms that when Kuba provided him with the copy of the first report, dated 22 January 2014, Musing requested that Kuba add a summary of his evidence. Kuba then attended to adding his evidence and providing Musing with a signed copy of the first report. Although the adding of Kuba's evidence was concluded a few days after the 22nd January 2014, the date of the first report reflected the 22nd January 2014 nonetheless. The submission of the first report was, in Musing's mind, a final submission of the report. In support of this version by Musing, we have been provided with a memo addressed to the NDCP following from the consideration by Musing of the first report, wherein Musing makes a recommendation to the NDCP to make certain action in this matter. It would not follow for Musing to make such recommendation on the basis of the first report exempt at the time if in his opinion the investigation was not complete and or the first report was not finalized at the time at that time. As outlined in section A and B above, it is apparent that the two reports differ significantly in respect of the recommendations made in this report. During an interview with Kuba, he alleged that the second report was created as a result of two factors which necessitated the drafting of the second report. These factors were the surfacing of new information being information regarding severe cell phone analysis and a few outstanding statements, and discussions between Kuba, McKnight, and Sisogo regarding the analysis of the evidence. We find it difficult to reconcile ourselves with the reasons given by Kuba for the publication of the second report on the following basis. One, it is the decision of both Mukangwe and Musing that the evidence regarding Sears' cell phone records were already known to Kuba before submission of the first report. As such, any additional analysis of the cell phone records could not add any material evidence to the report. Two, upon perusing the second report, there is no material information which has in fact been added in respect of the cell phone analysis of Sears' phone records. Three, contrary to there being no material evidence relating to Spears' cell phone records, in fact, material evidence regarding Spears' cell phone records, specifically evidence relating to the SMS sent by Spears to Ramat and others who were involved in the operation, were deleted and did not appear in the second report. Four, the additional statements contained in the report, namely that of Ramat Spears, Malibu, and Jennifer Iris Kobushian, do not contain material evidence which is capable of justifying an alteration in the conclusion of the report. Five, Cooper states that in discussions with the court, his attention was drawn to the fact that the evidence against them may not withstand scrutiny in court, and that Ramat simply having knowledge of the operation was not sufficient to implicate him criminally. This version by Cooper is contradicted by Cooper himself, who states that he agrees that the knowledge of a crime is sufficient. Furthermore, Cooper's version is not consistent in that Cooper himself drafted the first report recommending the prosecution of Ramat, which report was drafted with input from Hussein Mwelechi, who had more experience with the NPA itself than CISO. And six, as an active investigator, Cooper would have to have a basic understanding of the workings of the law and would have or ought to have understood that his mandate is to investigate and to report and not to assume the role of the court in evaluating and testing evidence hypothetically. Further to the above, both Angus, who has substantial experience as an investigator in Musim, confirm that if a report is submitted and new evidence comes to light subsequent to the submission of such report, the report may be updated to include the additional information. Any such updates would not affect the status of the first report. Should the actual reasons which necessitated the submission of the second report be, as Cooper stated, being to update the report with new evidence, the logical conclusion would be that the recommendations of the first report would not be amended unless the additional information was so material that it required the alteration of a recommendation contained in the first report. In our opinion, and for the reasons discussed above, the additional information which, according to Cooper, necessitated the submission of the second report was not sufficient or material, and therefore did not require a change in the outcome of the report. In light of the above, Cooper's alleged reasons for publishing the second report do not seem to be completely truthful. On discrepancies between the two reports, the following material discrepancies are noted between the first and second reports. One, portions of the statements of individuals who implicate Ramat's involvement in the revision which appear in the first report have been deleted in the second report. Two, the summary of evidence relating to the central records of individuals has been altered to leave out information of evidential value. Three, the analysis and findings of the second report have been altered and truncated to no longer evaluate the evidence against Ramat, which alteration coincides with the deletion of information implicating Ramat in the individual statements. Four, and the recommendation in the second report has changed drastically from recommending the prosecution of Ramat via Maluleke, Adebe, Nkosi and Makuwe in the first report to no longer recommending the prosecution of the aforesaid individuals other than Maluleke. The discrepancies listed above, and specifically the removal of pertinent evidence, is not justified in any way and appears to be effected in order to justify the conclusion that Ramat should not be prosecuted for his involvement in the rendition. On the explanation for the discrepancies, we have interviewed each of the core signatories of the second report, and none of the core signatories have been able to offer a valid explanation for the discrepancies listed above. For ease of reference, we will address the responses of each of the three core signatories separately below. On Cuba, before the discrepancies between the reports were drawn to Cuba's attention, Cuba volunteered that he did not mention each page of the report and is therefore unable to determine if any information has been added or removed in the second report. Secondly, according to Cuba, he simply signed the first report and provided CISO with a copy of the signed report, and he is not aware of how the signed second report was provided to the NPA from that point. Three, once the discrepancies had been drawn to Cuba's attention, Cuba explained that the analysis of the cell phone evidence had been changed in the second report in order to summarize the evidence in a concise manner. Four, However, he was unable to explain any of his discrepancies, and he indicated that he was concerned by the deletion of information in the summary of the individual statements. Fine. Cooper states that he was not responsible for the deletions, nor is he able to indicate who was responsible for the deletions. Six, on a weighing of the evidence before us and the testimonies of each individual interviewed, we accept Cooper's version of aspects of events. This acceptance is not without difficulty in light of Cooper's failure to explain the discrepancies between the first and second reports, considering that he is the author of the first report and the co-author of the second report, as well as the fact that Cooper failed to disclose information during his interview with Draxman, in which information was relevant to the investigation. Seven, the aforesaid information relates to the complaints made by the sworn affidavits by Cooper and Viceroy Maoka to the National Director of Public Prosecution in respect of Balwin. In their affidavits, the complainants state in earlier that Balwin has failed to uphold his initial consideration not to prosecute Ramat. The purpose of this complaint is unclear and seems to illustrate that Cooper misinterprets his role as investigator required to make recommendations in an investigation report which is meant to be a tool to assist the NPA in deciding whether or not to prosecute. This complaint came to our attention through Balwin and not Cooper himself. Lastly, additional information which Cooper failed to bring to our attention was that he sought legal opinion of Advocate Barry Rue in relation to the second report on Siso. Siso was stated that he was never given the first report, hence the absence of the signature in that report. According to Sissoko, the only report he has ever seen is the second report. This above version is contradicted by Cooper, who states that he emailed a copy of the first report to Sissoko to be provided to McBride before Cooper met with McBride. It is further contradicted by Sissoko himself, who corroborates Cooper's version that he received an email copy of the first report from Cooper to provide to McBride. Additionally, Mukanga stated that Sissoko, Cooper and himself attended at the offices of the NPA in order to submit the first report of the first report to the NPA. Sissoko's version is that he is not aware of any discrepancies or deletions in the second report, and that his involvement in the drafting of the second report was only supervisory, and he never actually worked on the report. It is directly contradicted by Cooper's version that he and Sissoko worked on the report together, and Sissoko gave substantial input in the alteration of the recommendation on the basis of what could be proven in a court. It is clear from Sissoko's responses that Sissoko did not take us into his confidence, and his reaction to questioning in respect of the reports was a bare denial of any meaningful involvement in the submission of the second report and any knowledge of the first report. On McBride, McBride states that he had no input in the report other than to make grammatical changes. Conveniently, it is not possible to prove this with documentary evidence because the manuscript changes made by McBride were destroyed to prevent documents being leaked. Notwithstanding that, McBride vehemently confirms that he stands by the recommendation contained in the second report. He admits that he did not read any of the evidence contained in the document, nor did he have sight of the first report. McBride's version of events is that he was provided with a second report, which had already been signed by Sissoko and Cooper, and that he then signed the second report himself. McBride was allegedly not aware of the first report or any discrepancies in the reports, and he did not allow us to draw his attention to say. McBride accepts that generally investigation report is signed by the investigating officer. Sorry. However, in relation to the second report, McBride records his reason for signing the report as that the matter involved two provinces. It is difficult to accept McBride's version for a number of reasons, including one, it is highly unlikely that an executive director of IBIC, who requested an update on high profile matters within a week of his appointment, that McBride was not aware of press reports. Two, that Cooper states that upon first meeting with McBride on the 6th of March 2014, that it was evident from their discussions that McBride had had regards to the first report. Three, McBride's version is contradicted by Cooper, who states that McBride's input into the report went beyond just grammatical changes. Four, in addition, the reason given by McBride for signing the second report, being that the matter involved two provinces, is contradicted by Cooper, who stated that this reason was never presented to him as being the reason for signature of the report by McBride, but that McBride signed the second report as a result of his participating therein. Five, McBride states that he is not aware of any deletions in either report, nor was he interested in having his attention drawn to same. Considering that McBride, in his capacity of executive director, is in the center of the rendition investigation, this is perplexing as to why he would not consider the discrepancies between the first and the second reports in order to be in a position to address them. Six, McBride vehemently supports the conclusion in the second report that he personally signed, without having considered on his own version the contents of the first report, and more importantly, the evidence in the docket. Seven, McBride's version that he did not have regard to the evidence in the docket is predicted by Cooper, who states that on 6 March 2014, a mere 3 days after McBride's appointment, McBride requested that Cooper retrieve the docket from the National Prosecuting Authority and provide McBride with every document that Cooper had in relation to the matter. Cooper furthermore confirms that it was not necessary in his view for the docket to retrieve in order to add any evidence to it. Eight, by significance, there are a number of contradictions between the statement provided to Westmans by McBride and the statement of facts by McBride contained in a sworn affidavit by himself relating to the rendition. For instance, in his own affidavit before the High Court of South Africa Gauteng Provincial Division on page 9 and page 11, paragraphs 24.1 and 27, respectively, of his affidavit, McBride makes reference to the first report as a preliminary draft of the report of the 20th of January 2014, close quote, and as quote-unquote the draft and linked report. Not only is this contrary to his own version that he did not have sight of the first report, but referring to the first report as a preliminary report is contradicted by the testimony of Cuba, being the actual author of the first report, and Mohsin being a member of the investigating team, instrumental in submitting the first report, who states that the first report was considered to be final. Furthermore, as stated above, Angus states that in his experience as an investigator of IBIC, a preliminary report does not contain recommendations. This view by Alice is given credence by the fact that the preliminary report, which itself records that it is not a final report, does not contain recommendations. At page 10, paragraph 34.2 of his affidavit, McBride states that, I quote, the provisional findings and recommendations were found to be unsustainable on the evidence and were accordingly not included in the final investigation report of 18 March 2014, close quote. This is a further contradiction to the version put forth by Webmans, by McBride. Who stated that he did not have regard to the first report, nor did he have regard to the evidence contained in the document. As such, McBride would not be able to pronounce on whether or not the findings of the first report were unsustainable on the evidence. Additionally, it would be difficult for McBride to draw such a conclusion if as he stated. The only input he had into the second report was related to grammatical changes, and that he was furthermore not provided with a copy of the second report for signature once Kubari Sisoba had signed the report. At page 22, paragraph 51.2 of his affidavit, McBride states, I quote, I want to make it abundantly clear that the final report was the product of a thorough investigation process, which included taking into account all the evidence gathered through the active investigation and making reasonable recommendations on the basis thereof. This statement appears to contradict McBride's version that he did not have regard to the evidence contained in the documents, and that his involvement in the second report was limited to grammatical change and signature of the second report. On page 23, at paragraph 51.5 of his affidavit, McBride states that, I quote, the preliminary draft of the IPD investigation report was also still subject to consideration and review by Sisoba and myself. This statement is contradicted by both McBride and Sisoba. McBride stated that the only input he had into the second report related to grammatical changes, and Sisoba said that his role was merely supervisor. And a further notable contradiction to McBride's version, as put forth to Bergman's, is found on page 23 and 24 of his affidavit, paragraph 51.6, wherein McBride states, I quote, the IPED investigation was conducted in cooperation with Advocate Anthony Mosin and Advocate Billy Moleti from the offices of the NDPP, both of whom were involved with the IPED investigation into the illegal rendition of Zimbabwe Muslims, even before a complaint was lodged with IPED. They remained in the investigation throughout and were provided with regular preliminary reports by the investigating officer, Mr. Fuwa. This statement is contradicted by Mosin, who states that he was not involved in the submission and or drafting of the second report. The analysis and findings have also been altered to remove an analysis of evidence which may implicate Ramat and Osdia. The alteration of the recommendation seems to be a non-sequitur in light of the fact that the so-called additional information added to the second report does not appear to be capable of justifying an altered conclusion. In the absence of the valid explanation for the deletions by the co-signatures, the only logical conclusion which can be drawn from circumstances detailed above is that the second report was created for the purpose of exonerating the high-ranking officials, especially specifically Bamant and Spear, who were implicated in the first report. It is difficult to ascertain who is responsible for the deletion of the portions of the statements which appear in the first report and which do not appear in the second report. It is evident to us that none of the co-signatures to the report are being truthful in respect of their involvement in the submission of the second report. Each of the core signatures to the second report deny effecting the deletions. We are of the view that the deletion of material evidence which is likely to affect the decision of the NPL in determining whether or not certain individuals should be prosecuted in the criminal offence, specifically defeating the ends of justice or obstructing the administration of justice. On whether any misconduct or offence has been committed and so by whom, the question is dealt with within our responses to 5.3 below. Whether it's prima facie evidence of misconduct or criminal liability by Lieutenant Ramat, Major General Sia, and any other officers mentioned in the original report. In a statement oversized the reason for the publication of the second report to be as a result of new evidence coming to light. This evidence, according to Fuba, related to the cell phone records of Sibir as well as the discussions held amongst Sogo McBride and Sani. Notwithstanding that the purported reasons for the publication of a second report do not appear to relate to Ramat, it is clear from a perusal of the first and second report that a large volume of information that relates to and in fact incriminates Ramat, which appeared in the first report, has been removed from the second report. These portions of the first report which were removed have the effect of distancing Ramat insofar as the involvement with the violation is concerned. Even if the first version of events is to be accepted and the decision was taken to change the recommendation in respect of Ramat's due to the view that there was not enough information to prosecute Ramat, this still does not explain why information relating to Ramat was deleted. Cuba has not been able to provide us with a plausible explanation for the removal of the information, nor are we able to draw any inferences other than that the removal has been effected in order to justify the failure of the second report to recommend Ramat to prosecute criminally, whereas the first report made such a recommendation. When Cuba was confronted with the totality of the deletions during our interview, Cuba responded in part with surprise and concern. Upon perusal of the first report, and specifically Cuba's analysis of findings in respect of Ramat, we agree and support Cuba's analysis of findings, which resulted in a recommendation that Ramat be criminally prosecuted. Without replicating the basis of Cuba's findings, which is available in the first report, we will summarize them briefly below. On Ramat having met with the Zimbabwean police prior to the commencement of the operation, Matlonga's statement reflects that he was stationed at the border when the Zimbabwean police officers attempted to cross into South Africa for the purposes of meeting with Ramat. Matlonga placed a call to Razlani and Mabuso, who both corroborate this evidence. In order to verify the events by the Zimbabwean police, Matlonga was even provided with Ramat's cell phone number by Superintendent Mube of the Zimbabwean police, who identified himself to Matlonga as the leader of the group. Matlonga contacted Ramat in order to confirm the events by the Zimbabwean police that they were going to meet with Ramat. And according to Matlonga, Ramat confirmed that he was aware of the Zimbabwean police's presence and that Matlonga should let them cross the border into South Africa. In addition to the above, the success report dated the 4th of February 2011 addressed to Inter Alia Ramat and signed by Leone Pastor records as its first point that on 5th November 2010 the Zimbabwean police visited the office of the PCI and engaged in a meeting with Ramat regarding Zimbabwean nationals who allegedly shot and killed a senior of the Zimbabwean police officer. The success report further more gives information relating to the arrest of two of the wanted Zimbabwean nationals. This success report was addressed to Ramat, and there is no record of Ramat contradicting any statement of fact within the success report. The above information should be viewed in the context of the fact that, as mentioned in the summary of Cuba's evidence, in a meeting with Cuba in Mukango, Ramat stated that he did not remember meeting with the Zimbabwean police. On receiving communication during and after the commissioning of the narration, the cell phone records of Sudia show that their SMSs were sent to Ramat at various milestones in the operation. Ramat also received an SMS from Maluleke shortly after the arrest of the Zimbabwean nationals. It's page 16 of the distributed copies. Page 16. Yeah. In addition to the above, there's evidence that emails circulating 20 photos of both Zimbabwean nationals and the police members involved in the operation were sent by Maluleke to Ramat's personal assistant. We believe that it is reasonable to deduce in the circumstances that these emails were brought to the attention of Grants through this special session. On congratulating members of Crime Intelligence after completion of the operation, according to the testimony of Musafide and Mugwenya, Dramat attended the offices of the DPCI and thanked the officers present for their participation in arresting the Zimbabwean nationals. Kasibe went further to state that Dramat warned them not to tell anyone about the operation. Mugwenya did not confirm Dramat's warning. It is recorded that Mugwenya admitted to Fuga that he knew Dramat for their mutual time in Mkondo Isizwe. In addition, a third officer Mokobu testifies that she was not at the office when Dramat attended. However, upon her return, she was informed by her colleagues that Dramat had attended in order to congratulate them on a job well done. On the statement to acting the National Commissioner of the South African Police Service, according to the erstwhile acting National Commissioner of the South African Police Service, Lieutenant John Connors, in late 2011 news of the rendition, when it came to light, he contacted Dramat to confirm that members of his group transported the Zimbabwean nationals as illegal immigrants. Connors then summoned Dramat to his office. Dramat arrived with Maluleke. Maluleke informed Connors that he was investigating a case of LTA bombings which led to the Zimbabwean nationals. Once he realized that they were not linked to the ATM bombing case, he decided to deport them after getting the necessary documentation from Home Affairs. When Mukanazi asked whether it was necessary to transport illegal immigrants, Dramat could offer no explanation. Not only that, they are about to say that Dramat had knowledge of the events, but his failure to offer a valid response to the question of whether it was necessary to transport the Zimbabwean nationals illustrates that either Dramat did not exist the level of control and oversight that he is required to by virtue of his position. Alternatively, Dramat was attempting to cover up the rendition operation as he was aware that it was unlawful. In our view, the above information is sufficient to create a prima facie impression that Dramat is guilty of both criminal and disciplinary misconduct, and that the circumstances surrounding his involvement in the rendition and the decision of whether or not to prosecute Dramat bears further consideration by the National Prosecuting Authority. On this year, we have produced and considered the contents of both the first and second report in order to establish whether there is prima facie evidence of misconduct and potential criminal liability against Sidia. It is alleged that Sidia was involved in the operation of the 5th of November 2010 as well as the operation of the 22nd to the 3rd November 2010. Sidia is the head of the Homes Unit. From our reading of the two reports regarding Homes, we have gathered that the main objective with the establishment of the Homes was to fight fraud and crimes. This includes inter alia, combating counter robberies by dangerous criminals, investigating and arresting those responsible for alien bombings. To be updated as follows. I quote, the reality of the matter is that operation in question was conducted under the auspices of DPCI National Head Office, and they requested the services of my team because of their training and capacity to those roles. This revelation by Sidia confirms his knowledge of the operation that led to the rendition of the Zimbabwean nationals. He provided Tom's personnel to assist DPCI National Head Office to carry out the rendition. Furthermore, in terms of our reading of the annexes and two reports, Maluleke carried out the operational instructions of his superiors. The rendition was carried out by the members of Tom's under the leadership of Maluleke. The first report suggests that Sidia not only functioned the operation but also that he actually participated in the rendition. Several statements and affidavits from various witnesses confirming the participation of Sidia in the rendition were obtained. We give you these statements here and below for the sake of completeness. Bongani 10 billion, the statement is annexed as A4 to the quarter report states that. And with your permission, Chair, can I ask that because those are individual sort of statements that are now also at the disposal of the honorable members, given the discipline of the report that I skip that.
That's fine.
And just resume on page 65 after the citation of those particular statements. That the aforesaid statements by the eyewitnesses from Crime Intelligence confirm that the operations on the 5th, the 22nd, and the 23rd November 2010 were carried out in connection with the murder and robbery case that took place in Zimbabwe where the police superintendent was killed. This conclusion is confirmed by the presence of Zimbabwean police officials during operations. The above statements were made under oath and are from the Zimbabwean nationals as well as members of Crime Intelligence who claim that they also spear at either the first or second operation of the plantation. As mentioned earlier in this report, an analysis of the cell phone records of Sibiya purportedly does not place him at the scene of the first operation in which he is alleged to have participated. However, it is not clear whether, solely on the basis of the aforesaid analysis of the cell phone records, that Sibiya can be said to be placed in Pretoria in respect of both the first and second operations, in light of the consistent eyewitness testimony which places at the scene of both operations, although the inference is drawn from the analysis of cell phone records that Sibiya was in Pretoria. The most that can be concluded in this regard is that Sibiya's cell phone was in the same location at the time is an assumption. At that time it was an assumption, and given the weight of eyewitness evidence to the contrary, would be a questionable conclusion. It is our view that there is a clear contradiction between the conclusion to be drawn from the evidence of the eyewitness discussed above, which places Sibiya in jail at the time of the operations, and the analysis of cell phone records, which infers that Sibiya was located at Pretoria in Sunnyside at the relevant time. It is our view that this contradiction could be tested and weighed by the National Prosecuting Authority and or a court of law. We cannot discount one piece of evidence against the other. Neither can we recommend that certain weight be placed on certain evidence and or recommend that certain piece of evidence be disregarded without it having been tested in a court of law or some forum. Further to the above, the mere allegation that the members of Crime Intelligence have conspired against Sibiya by giving their eyewitness testimony can never be a rational basis to discount their evidence or to fail to test the credibility of these witnesses or the veracity of their versions against the contrary evidence and conclusions which lead from the analysis of cell phone records. According to our investigation, we have established that the analysis of cell phone records serve two purposes. First, to assess the specific location of a phone at a certain time, and secondly, to assess the trail of communications for which the cell phone was utilized. In terms of the first assessment, Sibiya's cell phone records place his cell phones at Sunnyside in Pretoria. According to this, Sibiya was not present at any of the operations as alleged by the eyewitnesses. The second assessment of Sibiya's cell phone records showed that Sibiya communicated with officers who were involved in the operation, one of which is Malubi Lulege, sent SMSs to Ramati at the 082-551-5301 number during various milestones of the rendition. For records, in the first report that Ramati never responded to any of the SMSs from Sibiya. In our view, there is a prima facie case of kidnapping or defeating the ends of justice or obstructing the administration of justice to be made against Sibiya. it is our view that he knew about the operation that led to the rendition. He provided a team of police officers to search and arrest the Zimbabwean nationals suspected of killing the superintendent from Zimbabwe. As the political head of the PCI, he sanctioned the rendition. He allegedly gave directions to the members of Congress on where to detain the Zimbabwean nationals. The cell phone records show detailed communications between Sibiya and Maludege and Dramatis, despite the latter not responding to the SMS. On the circumstances under which the second report and a docket was handed to the NPA, and what happened to the docket was in the NPA's possession. According to Musing, the NPA's involvement in the matter was called for in the early possible stages of the investigation into the relation. Further, the former Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development, the Honorable Jeff Handel, addressed a conference of senior ministers of the NPA during 2012, wherein he called for the allegations into the rendition to be investigated, as the government were concerned about the possible violation of international law during the rendition. It is against this backdrop that the Special Project Division in the office of the NDCP was requested to provide guidance to the IP investigation team led by Kuba. The Special Project Division team was headed by Musing, assisted by Mwele. The team met with Kuba sometime in July 2013. The team produced the preliminary report into the rendition on the 22nd October 2013. Musing and Mwele advised that to conduct further investigations into certain aspects of the report. On 12th November 2013, Musing addressed an internal memorandum to the NGPP and the GNGPP. This memorandum sought to provide an update on the progress made by the Special Projects team and the investigation team led by Kula. The memorandum goes on to say that there was outstanding evidence that Kuba and the team had to obtain or get in order to finalize the preliminary report. According to Musing, the outstanding information related to warning statements from Bamad, Spear and Malege, an analysis of the cell phone data, as well as a report on the analysis of vehicle tracking information of the members involved in the operation during the rendition. The investigation team finalized its investigation on or about the 22nd January 2014 and compiled the report with final recommendations. This was the final report on the investigation in the rendition. It was handed to the Special Projects team so that the NDPP could make a decision to either prosecute or not prosecute those indicated in the report. On the 13th February 2014, Musing addressed another internal memorandum to Jiba and Chau, indicating that the investigations had been finalized and that the report from ISIS had been submitted for the purposes of considering the merits of the case. This internal memorandum also enclosed the docket comprising of two liver archives together with other files containing the cellular phone data and evidence obtained from a computer belonging to the DPCI. According to Shaoke, the receipt of the internal memorandum from Hussein on or about 14th February 2014 was preceded by a meeting wherein the NDPP advised Shaoke to consider the docket and take a decision in regard to say. Shaoke, assisted by Advocate Panzei, who is the Deputy Director of Public Prosecutions for South Gauteng, subsequent to the internal memorandum from Musing, the docket was handed to the office of Shaoke for a decision on whether to prosecute on the matter. According to Shaoke, before his office could even make a decision on the matter, Kuba and Angus from IPEX collected the docket from Advocate Panzei's office on the 7th of March 2014 and signed a receipt thereof. It does mention that this office shortly after my was appointed as the executive director of IPEX. According to Kuba, he collected the docket following an instruction from a client for him to do so. On 18 June 2014, Advocate Kasim telephoned Kuba requesting the docket from the latter. Kuba told him that McBride had instructed him to return the docket to the NDPP and that this has been done. Kuba did not give or specify the date by which the docket was returned to the NDPP by himself. We are advised that Advocate Conseil telephoned Kuba for the second time to inquire about the docket, which his office has not received. Kuba told Advocate Conseil that it was never his intention to return the docket to Advocate Conseil anyway. We are advised that in light of this information from Kuba, Advocate Conseil telephoned Hussein to inquire whether the docket has been returned to the office of the NDPP. Hussein advised him that the dockets were never returned to him. According to Taufi, he addressed a letter on the 3rd of July 2014 to the NDPP, informing him about the above sequence of events regarding the dockets. We are advised that the NDPP officially responded to the letter on the 20th of August 2014, indicating that the NDPP is in the process of considering the matter and that Taufi may close its file. Sometime in December 2014, the NDPP inquired from Taufi about the case and wanted to know whether the latter was still involved in the matter. Taufi was surprised by this inquiry from the NDPP, as according to him, Taufi, he was instructed by the same NDPP to close his file on the matter. Taufi advised the NDPP that he had since closed his file on the matter and was not dealing with it anymore. We also contacted with the DPP for not outgoing Zinyat in relation to his aspect of our investigation. He has told us that he received a telephone call from the NDPP on and about the 10th of January 2015 asking him about his knowledge of the condition. Zinyat told the NDPP that he did not have a clue of what the NDPP was talking about. According to Zinyat, the NDPP told him that he had received the docket in the matter from Taoke and that the matter fell under Zinyat's jurisdiction because Gippsland was under Article 3, which fell under North Gauteng DPP. On the day this call was made, Zinyat was on leave. He only returned from leave on or about the 16th of January 2015. Shortly after his return, the docket was delivered to his offices. Zinyat spoke to his colleague, the DDPP for North Gauteng, Baloyi, regarding the docket and informed him that they must formulate a view on the matter. According to Zinyat, sometime in March 2015, he received a report, being the second report from the NDPP. This report summarized the statements in the docket and made its own recommendations as to who should be asked. Before Zinyat made his own recommendations, he approached the NDPP to understand certain things. The NDPP told him that there was a first report and that he should read it as well. The NDPP provided him with a copy of the first report. Zinyat shared this first report with Baloyi and they discussed the potential charges to be brought against those implicated in the report. Zinyat and Baloyi finalized their reading of the documents and the two reports and made recommendations on who should be charged and prosecuted. They sent their recommendations to the NDPP on the 13th of March 2015. We are advised that on the 31st March 2015, the NDPP wrote another letter to Taufi informing him that that matter has been referred to Zinyat, who has recommended that all the accused, including Bart and Spear, be prosecuted for Italia, kidnapping and defeating the ends of justice. This letter attached the letter addressed by Zinyat to the NDPP on the 13th of March 2015. We are advised that the aforesaid letter from the NDPP in the earlier states that the matter must be returned to the DPP Alpha again, because it now falls under the jurisdiction of the DPP subhousing since the 1st December 2014. Just from that date, this fell under the subhousing in terms of the government notice number 861 of the 31st October 2014. According to Kaoke, on the 1st April 2015, we received a box consisting of the docket with a letter containing GRC's recommendations. On evening date, we received a letter from the head of National Prosecution Services to conduct specific investigations in the matter. On any other matter that might come to your attention during the investigation, which is relevant to your conclusions and findings, in the context of the sequence of events described at 3.2.2, we have specific concerns that remain unanswered. As to how the docket was dealt with after it was received by the NDPP, these concerns are as follows. 1. In February 2014, the NDPP referred the matter to Chaoke, the DPP for South Kogeng, at a period when Gipsville fell under the jurisdiction of the DPP for North Kogeng. This amounted to a transfer of jurisdiction in terms of Section 32, Subsection 3 of the National Prosecuting Authority Act. In April 2014, the NDPP accepted the document back from McBride without having withdrawn the jurisdiction from Chaoke. In January 2015, the NDPP referred the matter to the DPP for North Kogeng after he was aware the jurisdiction in respect of this group had been changed to fall under the jurisdiction of the DPP for South Kogeng. This amounted to another transfer of jurisdiction in terms of Section 22, Subsection 3 of the NPA Act. And the NDPP failed to take action in respect of the recommendation made by engineers on the 13th of March 2015, but rather sent the docket back to Chaoke to make a decision on the matter. This amounts to a review by Chaoke of the recommendation made by engineers. This was done despite the fact that, in terms of Section 2, Subsection 2C of the NPA Act, the NDPP himself is authorized to review a decision to prosecute or not to prosecute taken by a DPP. There is no authority in the NPA Act which allows a DPP to review a decision taken by another DPP. The reason that the concern mentioned at 5.5.1.1 had not been addressed relates to the fact that the NDPP failed to respond to our request to meet with him. Interestingly, the NDPP is the only employee of the NPA involved in this matter who failed to meet with us in response to a request to meet. In the absence of any explanation regarding the questions raised at 5.5.1.1, it is our view that the role of the NPA in dealing with the first and second reports should be investigated. Section D on recommendations. For the reasons set out in the first report, we recommend that, this is with regards to Maluleke, we recommend that both criminal charges, in other words, contravention of the Immigration Act, kidnapping, fraud, forgery, and altering, defeating the ends of justice, or obstructing the administration of justice and assault, and disciplinary charges in his capacity as employee to work against Maluleke in his capacity. As an employee. With regards to Dramat, for instance, set out at 5.3.1 above, we recommend that both criminal charges, contravention of the Immigration Act, enabling keeping the ends of justice or obstructing the administration of justice, and disciplinary charges be brought against Dramat's capacity as an employee. With regards to Spear, for the reasons set out at 5.3.2, we recommend that both criminal charges, the same as mentioned with regards to the above two, be brought against the DA's in his capacity as an employee. On others, and recommended warrant officer Mark Webb be charged criminally for assault and that disciplinary action be taken against him in his capacity as an employee. We recommend that Liguo Hadem be charged criminally for assault and disciplinary action be taken against him in his capacity as an employee. We recommend that Ghost be charged criminally for assault and disciplinary action be taken against him in his capacity as an employee. We recommend that anyone involved in the fraud and forgery of the Home Affairs documents which were submitted in support of the deportation during the rendition be charged with forgery and altering as well as fraud. In the absence of any information as to which of the three co-signatories were responsible for the deletion of information from the first report, we recommend that Kuba, Mark Bryan, and Sisowo be charged criminally for defeating the end of justice or obstructing the administration of justice, and that disciplinary charges be brought against them in their capacities and release. Essentially, Chairperson, honourable members, this is where the report ends, besides the administrative passages that become part of the conclusion of the report. This is an investigation report from the... This is the presentation of the investigation reports from the freshman's attendees as commissioned by the Minister of Police. May I also just state that on two matters of the processes, I wanted to make some few comments on process. Precisely what the report makes a number of the conclusions and recommendations that affect a number of people that work in various sort of divisions in government. I've had to then refer this report for consideration for the next, with regards to the NPA. I've referred it to the President. I've also referred the same report to the Minister of Justice. I've also forwarded the same report with regards to members of the way it affects members of the House, for an example, to the acting head to PCI. I may be forgetting the fourth. I've also referred the same report to the acting head. Insofar as the question of the employees that fall under IP that are cited in the public investigation report. That's from a personal point of view. The second area that I've also in the light, you remember, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, that when a decision was taken to put Mr. Robert McBride in suspension, for instance, we said that subject to ongoing and further investigations. Now, at the conclusion of this report, this report was concluded and submitted to the Minister on the 24th of April. I subsequently took steps to accordingly proceed with the finding of the disciplinary steps and charges against Mr. McBride. And the process is expected to kick off on the 21st of May, 2014. Thank you very much. I've spoken a lot about this, about 2014. So my mind is working backwards. So,
what is the date now?
For a disciplinary hearing, it's set down for the 21st of May, 2014.
Thank you very much, Minister, for the presentation and the report. We take note of the contents and as well as the other process that's been spelled out and we'll monitor it going forward. Maybe just two questions from my side and then I'll also allow the other members, once the issues. The first issue deals with the leadership of IBIT. As indicated previously, it's a very important institution. Now, in your report as well, you've indicated the roles played by the suspended executive director and also the head of investigations, who are very serious people. Now, here's a commitment, I think also the public, we need assurances that if there is police, perpetrating crimes and wrongdoings, that there will be proper independent investigations and there must be clear blue water between the police and the IFAD. So if you can make just from that perspective, give us clear assurances that the current active leadership of the IFAD will ensure that happens, and also the issue of head up investigations in IFAD. Of course, that's also critical. We can't have a situation where executive director and head up investigations. There's of course a process, but they must be beyond reproach. So that's quite important for us. The second issue, Minister, I just want to also put on the table, during our discussions of the budget vote, the committee was, with regard to certain developments at SAPS, disappointed with certain actions from the National Commission. And we've also stated that in our budget report that was adopted last week. There's also a letter coming to you with regard to that. Now, we are aware of the issue of the water reference group established by yourself with regard to the police leadership. Maybe we can just maybe also at this stage, maybe just give us an update on that process. That's the two for me, sir. Honourable Mabasi.
Thank you,
Mr.
Let me thank the minister for the report that she has come live. My questions are as follows. The chief investigating officer, Kuba, is he still at work? Or what happened so far? My next one is there a particular reason why these four Zimbabwean nationals who were arrested at Kislo were locked up at Orlando and Alexander police station? Is there a particular reason? My next one is Captain Maluleka criminally charged as SSP, because according to the recommendation, he was supposed to be charged. If he charged now, that's what he did. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Abadji. Honourable Bula, are you fine? Honourable Mabija?
So thank you, Chair. So, I just want to ask this from the Minister. As we're going on with the thinking of the report, the main question of whether Sovereign Officer Eva Mabiron, who was also given the information there, and that Mabiron be buried him. So I'd like to know from the minister if they have tried to find out whether Mabiron died because of man-made methods of operation, or it was a natural death. If they ever try to find out precisely what has gone wrong, because it's there in the report. Because as a human being, you have said that something went on normally. I read the thing that way. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Bija. Honourable Martin. Yvonne, Honourable Premier.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, before I want to ask the real question, can I just ask the copies we received? Is it a direct copy of the report from Dashmas, or has it been the report retyped? I just want to know that.
Yeah,
okay, because what I want to say, Chairperson, is if it is a direct copy, then maybe we should give the report for McBride to look at the spelling of the report. Because I don't think it's very professional for a company to give a report like this with all the spelling mistakes, and I'm no expert on English, but even I can see the problem. My question to you, Chairperson. I've heard what the minister said, but I want clarity. Firstly, on Lieutenant General Dramat, is the minister now telling us that he's going to be prosecuted or not? Because the recommendation is that he must be prosecuted. But in the meanwhile, at the time, the minister had made a deal with him. So I'd like to know exactly what is going to happen when it comes to the remark. It's the same with McBride. I'd like to know exactly if there's going to be disciplinary actions against him, but is he also going to be criminally charged as the recommendations of the court? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Tribal. Honourable Kuala.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, there's something that I find extremely curious about this report, its very origins, crime intelligence. One cannot dispute the fact that facts are here and they speak for themselves. But what is the first thing is origin? And there are the minister, at leisure, with time, can reflect on that in the first place. Reading and hearing the outliners given by the minister, one begins to question the motive of South Africans, very senior South Africans, taking it upon themselves to do things that apply in this report. What could have motivated them to do so? Was it primarily criminality? Was it national interest? What could have triggered the kind of interest in them to act in the manner they did? As that topic been explored, because it would be very interesting to know why would people go to such extremes to what they did? Naturally putting their job at risk. Was it in the national interest? What they affect? You know, there's mention made of a meeting held between the two police forces involved in Balakwa. I would presume that those are made up for politicians at Balakwa levels. Are they allowed to do so? If they are they then allowed to also generate operations which could impact upon their careers? These are issues that I would want us to be enlightened on.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just some opening remarks, and then I'm going to ask my questions, of which there are four. Obviously, we've just had a deluge of very detailed information that one would have liked to think was meant to clarify the situation, but instead it's really only confused matters further. In fact, I feel like I'm in that UN Security Council meeting just more than a decade ago when Colin Powell was trying to motivate for the invasion of Iraq. I'm hearing a lot of stuff coming at me, but I'm not getting something that is compelling enough to say, okay, that's the reason why things must go in that direction. So, the evidence in this report is mainly testimonials, and the problem comes in when we've seen that there were lots of contradictions between the testimonials, especially on key aspects of key events. Where there is reference to objective evidence, it seems entirely circumstantial. Like, for example, I'm not sure why communication between the head of the Hawks and investigators in the organization, which one would expect to happen regularly, whether or not it coincided with key milestones in a particular investigation, while that in and of itself would be grounds for arriving at a specific conclusion about a particular case, unless we know what the context of the communication is. So the timing of SMSs and calls and how many numbers are called so many times, in and of itself, for me, does not seem at the convincing grounds for arriving at specific conclusions. A curious feature of this report is that in some parts it makes evaluations about the materiality of various bits of evidence, both added and deleted sections that we had the breakdown in the second report. But the irony is that the report then also accuses Cuba of having inappropriately done that himself in the course of the investigation. So we have to be clear that if there's going to be evaluations of materiality made, and it was wrong for people to have done that in POPs. The report doing it in itself is also, it can be incriminated on the same grounds. Key concern for me is that the report says it could not ascertain who was responsible for the deletions. But surely that's the most crucial question, because that would shed some light on possible motives for the discrepancies that have been gone into in great detail. And I have to say that we have to keep in mind the larger picture here, because all of this started when the Hawks undermined requested the Ntandla files from the SAPS, and so that's when Dramatic Parallel started. And so now, as a kind of second act to the production, when the IFU failed to play its supporting role in this ongoing drive for state capture, guns turned on McBride. And to be entirely honest, I'm going to go out on a limb here to echo Honourable Kurabot. I'm not convinced, speaking about the whole theme of the force being chased, I'm not convinced that this report, in its entirety, and with regards to every detail, is in fact an unaltered document from government attorneys. Because it says just enough in the right tone to sound like a credible analysis of the relevant issues. Then it has these moments of making unfounded value judgments and being quite emphatic about wrongdoing or negligence on the part of different individuals. All of this in the context, as I said, of the contradictory CSA. So I don't think it represents the end of the process, because we're no closer to the truth, or a clearer truth. And I think we're only just getting started, and hopefully this committee will play a key role in unpacking the issues and use its power to uncover the truth. So here, I'm going to come to my questions now. The first was, in terms of the report, what does it mean exactly when the report says that McBride had regard to the report? That phrase stood out for me, and it was in the context of whether or not she knew about the first report, what did it do to the first report, etc. My second question is, there was also another interesting phrase, and this is where I keep going back to this issue of valuations or value judgments that appear in a report. Why was the bride considered to be in the center of the rendition investigation? That was the phrase used. So just a clarification on that. And then there was talk of a preliminary report. And we heard that the testimonial from Mr. McBride was that what is called the first report was in fact a preliminary report, but it couldn't be a prelim because prelims would have recommendations, and you know, we had that whole with more. So when the report talks about a preliminary report and that term not capitalized, what does that mean? What is that referring to as opposed to first report, second report, which were also capitalized? So I'm seeing three things, but I'm not sure what the preliminary report refers to. And then my last question is, because a lot was made about who signed what, where, and how. Was the first report signed by the acting director at the time? I missed that bit of information. But the second report was very clear, it was signed by three people and how it got there. But was the first report signed by the acting director at the time? Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Chair. Minister, the Supreme Court of Appeal has thrown out or petitioned to appeal the High Court ruling that the suspension of the then head of the Hawks, Amar Dramat, was unlawful and set aside, as saying, and I quote, "The application for leave to appeal is dismissed with cost on grounds that there is no reasonable prospect of success in an appeal and there is no other compelling reason why an appeal should be heard. You lost with costs, actually the taxpayer lost with costs. What you did by suspending the head of the Hawks in contravention of a constitutional court ruling was unlawful, and so it seems to me you went to, as a client, to a private law firm, not as a head of detectives, to a private law firm to attempt to justify your unlawful action ex post facto. Then you forced him out of the steps with a golden handshake. Now why didn't you leave him there, arrest him and take him to court? I mean, you had him right there, and you just gave him a fortune and said, go away. Why did you not wait for the NDA to make its decision first? That is surely where this matter should lie. Additionally, legal opinion claims it was entirely unacceptable, inappropriate, probably illegal, for you as minister to commission an investigation into a matter which was already before the National Prosecuting Authority. The Minister of Justice, not the Minister of Police, has responsibility for the NPA, and even he cannot intervene in a decision by the NPA about prosecution in any matter except to ask for a progress report. Now, it seems then that the Worksman's report should never have been commissioned or written, and the reality is that you, sir, cannot rely on it to justify your actions ex post facto. It does look as if the commissioning of this report was an effort by you to seek to salvage a situation in which court judgments went against you. Yes, you ignored them, but they did go against you, and when you failed to act in accordance with them. So I'd like an explanation on your decision to ignore the various court judgments. Now, by what authority and whose authority were documents removed or copied from the NPA and given to Wirtschmans, the private law firm, between February and April 2015? And there is a question being asked, was the action that you took, Minister, in commissioning this report legal? Where does it say in any law that you could do this? Did you avoid usurping the NPA's functions? If you did, show me in what act it says that you have the right to do this. I've never, in all my years on this committee, seen a minister do what you've done. I've seen detectives do it, head of detectives run a case, but I've never seen what you've done being done. Does or will the payment of the Wirtschmans report constitute fruitless or irregular state expenditure? I'd like to know how much the taxpayers paid for this report. Considering we have a raft of lawyers working here in Parliament and thousands of tax detectives, you went to private firms. So tell us what we're paying for this, and what is the lotus standi of a private firm to review the investigation and recommendations of the IPED? That will come up in court, should this ever hit a court. In terms of which legislation do you, sir, have any power to interfere with the recommendations of the IPED by appointing private attorneys to report back to you? Again, tell me how this was possible. Minister, I've not, in all of this, and in days and when you came to the committee to tell us the fire drama, I've not heard you condemn the actions of the Zimbabwean police that you have claimed over and over again have tortured and murdered fellow Zimbabweans. So, one man's not been seen for some time, you claim he must be dead. I suggest you use this platform here and now to do so. Minister, the Pretoria High Court ruled that the appointment of the person you referred to as the acting head of the IPED was unlawful and set aside, and yet here he sits. Then the North Gauteng High Court ruled that this unlawfully appointed acting head of Hawks was, and I quote, biased, dishonest and lacking in integrity and honour. He added that the suspension of the Gauteng Hawks boss was done without a shred of evidence, and yet he sits here in this meeting. I'm astounded. Now, I'd also like to know which of the reports you used to suspend Rama. Your spokesperson, Zondi, on the 23rd of December last year, said that Rama's suspension was a result of IPED recommendations. Now, because the official IPED recommendations did not just recommend suspension, discipline, or prosecution for Rama, was your spokesperson mistaken? Was he lying, or was he deliberately misleading the public? And why, Minister, with what legal right did you demand the docket from IPED on the 24th of December? That's not allowed by any law, to my knowledge. Please tell me what law allowed you to do that. And why did you mislead Parliament before this very committee to the effect you said that witnesses to this matter had died in mysterious circumstances? Now, that was the same statement used by your unlawfully appointed acting head, which earned him the without integrity label, from the judge in the Sabia case. When one witness died, his name was Madi Longwa, he actually died of natural causes. Nothing mysterious about it, yet you led this committee to believe that somehow witnesses were being bunked off. Minister, I've got two more, I'm done. Minister, are you aware of IPED Regulation 53I that negates the status of any report or recommendation if it does not come from the executive director or a provincial head? Please tell me whether you are or not. And finally, Minister, now that you've forced the head of the Hawks out, is this matter going to go to court? Of course, this report is nothing like it opens, which it seems to be, you seem to be giving that this kind of status in this body. It's not a judgment. It's a report by private lawyers answering to a client. It seems to me you're attempting to give it the status of a court ruling. It doesn't have that. And if you're so convinced today that this man was guilty of something, then arrest him and charge him and take him to court. Why did you not do that instead of giving him a golden handbag?
Right. Thank you, Minister. Thank you. Minister, I'm with you.
then take a case report, and this is how it implicates your the people under your supervision. And then at that point, they would have to then decide in terms of what group that they need. On the question of the, you know, why Zimbabweans they picked up in gifts with and looked up in Orlando and so forth. It's hit me, it's difficult to me to give you the logic behind safe to say this. Again, perhaps I should tie in with the point that Ms. Kolabana she spoke to. And that's a question, and that's the fact that this is not a judgment. It's true, it's not a judgment. Of course, it's an investigation. So that's what we have said. It's not a judgment of innocence. And that's why it made the recommendation. Any judgment, as you know it, what it was, it made an order. So there are no orders in this city, so in any judgment, you could say whatever, and then it could reach a point where you say, I hereby order. So these are the recommendations. So, and therefore that means there is another step in this movement that needs to be entered in. And that is now establishing, for an example. Now we know what happened, this is what the report was, and how we have it before. This is how it happened before. But why it happened, that's what we don't know. And Mr. Parliament, that's also the question. Why it happened? That's what we don't do. But if you have only established an high bank, it means you must then develop a different process altogether to process the issue. Okay? Is it because there's something systematically wrong, or is it because of some degree of fairness amongst ourselves that we could eventually be, you know, to lump together with these kinds of serious allegations? I don't know, I can't say that thought on this one. But also the high factor will sort of deal with the question of, yeah, so what was this of picking up somebody in Gibbsburg, locking that person up in Orlando, but then the following day that person is locked up in Sydney. But it's through a particular process, and that process is that I think it's nearly all ADAP process, for example, in the court of law. So, and I think we need to understand that this does a past judgment or anything. All of these different policies are my assumption that innocent, they are also presumed to be innocent. Until, of course, we subject them to a particular process that must finally arrive at a definite sort of conclusion about issues having tested evidence and counter-tested that kind of evidence and so forth, and then arrive with the correct. So,
I'm trying to clarify this.
that's what they recommend, they report recommends. Okay. And it does, having gone through a set of issues, having interviewed people, having interrogated documentation for an example, having looked into all sorts of manners and necessary sort of supporting documentary evidence and otherwise, including testimonial as somebody said, and then say, on the basis of all this is our and that recommendation, the decision, can only be validated at the level of the National Prosecutor Authority in order to take the decision to proceed. By the way, in the same manner, that when this report arrives at that recommendation, there's nothing out of the ordinary. The same thing I did. Investigates, but even when they reach particular conclusions on the basis of the evidence and the material before them, they also recommend. We recommend that Mr. Funa, which is a very nice thing, must go to the prosecutor, that is making a
difference.
So I'm just saying that's the thing. So it's nothing out of the ordinary, but it's final evidence here is the National Director of Public Prosecutors take a decision. The prosecutor not to. So that's the that's one. Now,
yes. Yes, before he moves on, I have a problem. Yeah, please. So I'm quite. I do beg your pardon. Sorry.
Thank you, sir. On this specific point, I understand it. It's under the prosecuting authority they have to make the final decision. But under the minister asked for a report. And let's just get clarity on this issue. This report is about the two reports in Italy. This is what this report is about. It is not about the investigation in Dramato or anything like that. This report is about the two reports in Italy.
Right.
But now there are certain recommendations to the minister. And it's a simple question. I understand. But the question is, does the honorable minister support the recommendations? Mean by that, he says yes, but he can't determine the outcome. That we know. But my simple question is it a yes or a no? Does he support the recommendations of the report?
Yeah, I'd like some clarity in that the minister has just said the people in this report are considered to be innocent until proven in a court to be guilty in a court of law. And yet we have seen the head of the hawk drummed out. He was suspended just after asking for the Nkana report. He was never reinstated. He was locked out of the office. Apparently they changed the locks. And now he's been told, click here and how you want to get out of this place. And he's gone. So how do you say they're all innocent until proven guilty? The minister came to our committee and did fire this man. And when we said no, he went round the back of the wall and did it another way. So no, I have to disagree. Nobody in this report is considered to be innocent because drama has already been drummed out.
But in this respect, with due respect, he says, that's not even a special place. You don't know what you have to know. Yeah, that's a problem. And that's a really wrong second point because, you know, that's a healthy thing for you as a person, but for anything that represents innocence. Thank you. Nobody has been done now.
Uh-huh.
Now, nobody has. Now, even if you were to talk to the individuals, they would say, nobody has been forced out of this. Now, the fact of the matter is that when you took a decision, for instance, for time, and by the way, just for clarification, CJ Williams has said, we are not arriving at the present. You are saying, I don't know, make an example, Mr. Funeral, you're saying, Mr. Funeral, there is allegations against you. And therefore they need to be further processed through an investigation. And for your own protection, but also the protection of the institution, it's important that we investigate when you are not there, so that there are no allegations of interference. There are no allegations of interference with any other and so forth, and therefore insulates the investigative process. It's where this understanding is gotten from by Mr. Corabana, for instance, that when you suspend it means you are finding some of this, because there's no allegation. you are saying I must look into this, but also the investigative process has got to be isolated, and you look at the implicated person or a person, a person facing allegations should not be negatively impacted upon. Okay? But also the institution must be able to its own kind of process. Now, so that a fellow employee such as Mr. Kalanex to you, while you are investigating, begins to then say, hey, you must have seen how close everyone looks at me at this point, because they investigate. And so, so you feel threatened, but he makes negative allegations against you, and so forth. And that then clouds the investigative process. And so, when you are suspended someone, suspension has everything to do with that, not hanging someone's guilt from the guilt. So that's what we saw. Now, a of course, this report has got to be studied further from it. I mean, there are various sort of opinions that I'm also interacting insofar as specific areas that I recommended. So that then talks to the question, do I support some recommendations or do I support all recommendations and so forth? Around the legal ones, for example, you know, there's still further sort of the possibility of study work that one is for two. However, what I do support is that any institution that you allocate, you must be able to account for. So the principle of accountability for me is important, but also the principle of transparency is very, 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 very important when it comes to this. So what this report has effectively done is says this is what happened, how it happened, what the report is unable to establish in this case, why it happened. And that process is, can only be, you know, concluded as and when you place in a recommendations, whether some of them or all of them. And some of them are talking about disciplinary actions, some of them are talking of the legal process that has got to be followed by having to be for these divisions of justice and everything else and so on. That's the only way you can establish the one that comes. Now, the same way we can verify all the question of what you expect to do just the information that came in your direction, contradictions, that you know, testimonials and evaluations of the materiality, litigation, and whatever else was there. You know, all the beautiful layers things that we spoke about. The fact of the matter is that even that one, any evidence has got to be tested through the process. So, for instance, if you want to have this contradiction, then whether those contradictions are valid or not, it is through a legal process. If you want to, you know, continue conducting evaluations of the materiality and everything else, it is through a legal process that you then establish the discovery of this. Now, look, I accept that the spelling and the grammatical errors in the report, but does that make a report non-original? It has been in fact the African Youth Association as well, because when Mr. Mbele does it, you know, your issue about you agree with Mr. Kuhn, by the way, you agree with Mr. Kuhn about nothing, but I don't think the two of you agree. Well, he says he finds some of these things unprofessional. He's not doubting whether this is a technical fault, for example, yours. Yeah, talking whether this is what comes from government. And that's a better business question. Okay, so those are two different things we kind of use. So you may want to verify your attempts to which the two of you agree or not agree on. But my understanding of your point is that you are doubting the credibility of the report. He does. He says, yeah, but you know that these are grammatical things, and I agree with you. They are also. Of course, you cannot be just like I'm not. But you can identify that there are also issues. But I think we should also be careful that we do not begin to suggest that we probably do not intend to suggest. Because when you say, you are then saying the minister is appearing before a portfolio of the portfolio committee panel, and intentionally is bringing a report in the entire group to us to mislead the committee. Okay? Now, unless you have the way to substantiate such kind of an allegation, and of course this committee and the institution will then need to deal with it. So, I mean, what do you do with a minister that appears before a portfolio falsifies the report or a rewritten report, for example? Well, that's paramount decision. So I'm saying we need to be careful about no matter how we disagree or how we choose to disappoint it, because we have assumed such information.
Yeah.
And those assumed positions, they get disproved and are beginning to unravel in one form or another. So I'm saying, that's just my honest advice to the public, because in my brief experience with a person like yourself, I've never really experienced any deliberate negative intention on your side. It's not that you can calculate these things that you just need to be anything other than just being evaluative, objective, around this. So that's why I'm feeling patient with it. I think I take the quite seriously when you make inferences around this, because I don't know if you are as polluted as many people would when it comes to something with this particular need. Now, some of the issues, including the question for the issue that is relevant, the question of the issue of principles of the variation, the point of the variance between the two reports. What appears beside the report number two is now taken out and so forth. Even those very same are measures that must be subject to a test. And that test is either a disciplinary game or an end of the process, for example. That happens again. Okay? Now, when the reference is made to tribunal reports, I think now that you have the report is only made on the internet, the preliminary reports, and even in the basic report, it is just the preliminary report doesn't make recommendations.
Yeah.
It doesn't. And it refers to some preliminary report or reports of October 2013, somewhere. Those are processing reports between our investigators and the two gentlemen from the NPA who were assisting this kind of investigation. And that's why from the beginning we said, there's no way that the report of the 22nd of January had specific recommendations for people to charge the criminal and even disciplinary in a sense for being present with preliminary reports. Because, the example is simple. If I make a recommendation to the MPA today and say, Mr. Mbeki, it must be changed criminally, and then the MPP wakes up the following day and then charges, how do I withdraw that? How do I turn around and say, I was playing, and said, here's a preliminary report, in fact, now really coming back to the MPP to criminally uncharged. I mean, it's not possible. It's not possible. So, the report of January the 22nd, that's exactly the same. It's the final report. The investigators in this version of the report, they say that the final report, not the preliminary, the kind of report. Secondly, is that in law, insofar as the IT Act is concerned, I think that the institution forwards these reports to the National Security Authority if, for example, there is a case where there are recommendations for proceedings, but also forwards these reports to the Minister of Police. So that also the line of appointment and so on. Now, so I think we need also to find the it's still on that question. While everybody, this report is also illustrating that as a state, prepared to report for signing by the investigation on the second report. This is now the first report. The first report is on the 22nd January 2015. Some months before, this is not like the time in March, we have the room with the director of IP, assuming and so forth, a week later, the emergence of the second report. Right? The second report has got three signatures. First signature is Mr. Kubo, which is the chief investigator. The second signature is Mr. Sisto. The third, the last one, is Mr. Mokan. Now, so that's, but then also what we then going to have gone into is look at the this kind of variance. Why then we have variance of the between the two reports from the same institution, for example. I think you said something about you wanted to know what it meant by having done, and so on. I think that's really the English, but I think what it means is that we were in the knowledge of a particular and so forth. I'm not sure which, you know, chapter of the whatever line we're referring to is. You say that in the report it says it was at the center of the condition and so forth. I don't remember seeing that in the report. That is an outline was at the center of the condition. But remember that when the relation took place, now, Brian was not working for IT. The transition took place in 2020, and some of Brian was hired in 2014. So you couldn't have been at the center of the transition, not at all. So I think you may have been at that time. And so, now, and then you have the other issue that I raised for Mrs. Bernard here about unlocking. I don't know how many times I'll have to talk about this. I have not accepted unlocking. I have not accepted unlocking. Exactly, because even the provisions that were delivered by the Constitutional Court were not like the court, for instance, in the package, in that space. Exactly. Even the very same court that we were referring to knows, in fact, they can clarify you much more better than I suppose. Then said that the Minister of Police did not rely on Section 17 D, Section 2 of the SAPSA. If you take question by the Constitution, where would probably do the weather point is around, largely, I would say, the one that the deletion itself, even the interpretation of what the Constitutional Court actually said in that judgment, when they themselves said that they cannot find the basis of protecting, self-protecting the basis of Mr. Nissan as well. A right to, for an example, a suspect, the head of the judiciary, for lay themselves in the depth, the two states, which also acknowledges one fact, and that fact alone is the minister in a particular sentences has an oversight responsibility. But what does oversight do? And this is where, for instance, we then rely. For example, the public service, Act and sort of thing, and other things. So, then say that acting unlawful when I relied on law is just a contradiction of words. Because there's absolutely
I'm talking to the chairperson.
On the question, what authority relies upon the commission I do not know what is meant by that, unless the honorable member is able to change the name. There is this particular law, and this particular statute provision in the law, that says as a minister you cannot commission a new client. Now, and let me just say, investigations and or inquiries are important events. The manner you conduct and how you construct the structure to conduct any fire department adoption. We always need to achieve nothing else in the main, but legitimacy, independence and credibility is very important. And then in appointing Beckman's attorneys for an example, those are professionals who conduct the professional mistakes and grammatical issues. But there are those that people that have got a passion to defend and reputation to also uphold. And therefore, you would, you know, relatively rely on them to command a credible reform or exercise in the investigation so that, as a minister, you are then somewhat empowered to be able to deal with the. Now, there was a question that the witness is dying to receive it. I'm sure that in that presentation, that's what I did. I said, if I'm not mistaken, for the specific I think it was. Of course, I think it's in reference to letting the candidate make loan as well. Because what happened to letting the candidate make loan is that he got an instruction to come in and then something here to take away from the district, and I still have to be called the school to go. So he left the book alive the way that we can have 3 days later. Was there here. Now, and all I was saying was that the problem of not attending to these issues on time and addressing what we then begin to have is, you know, a witness of a particular business person getting lost in the process, like in the case of Magellan. Where do you find Magellan at the beginning? And yet Magellan made a particular statement from the country in terms of what transpires in so much as Jesus is concerned at the border post in Vegas and so on. You know, so those are some of the things that I was concerned about. But, you know, I'm sure that this was not a formulation that I used in that presentation about people dying in the university or something like that. It's just that I do not have the echo catch. Why I demonstrated and that we can then deal with as and when we see and explain the course. Now, the issue of court judgment, and there's a number of things that have been said about the abolishment and so forth. And of course, we are also a lot of record having said, of course, we disagree with some of the judgments and we are following the good process. In taking those matters up with the respective courts and so on. What I'm happy about though is that some of the issues that we somewhat in the dark when we started on this particular matter are coming out in the field. For instance, when John Ramat was suspended in December, a number of things were said, and this is in the same way, that this is called a vanity speed on, because of a design. It's not about design, but must be even other dubious ulterior motives for action. And that's all of, not all of you here, but some of you here, as members of the parliament, you've also dealt with this issue. When I was not in the game. If the matter arose in question, and it's a member of the parliament who asked the question in 2011, 2012, you were all here. Yeah? about this particular matter, the religion, for example. So it's not invented. And where was it done then? Now I come in 4 years later, I find, and this thing has got to be, you have got to do nothing else except taking it to this logical conclusion. What do you do? And then you get told, oh yeah, of course, you guys have been investigated. If not in London, they are seriously investigated and left. The minister is trying to whatever, so. Now, what I'm thinking about this report is that this report is beginning to then say, thinking has got changed. Your statement, your witnesses, your, you know, I've got to say everything that you were capable in combining this report. People will then say, but this is what we can send in and say this is what happened. Whether it's, you know, court or law or inquiry or any other person, we can say facts in terms of what we know about what transpired. And no one then says anything about the event that we investigated, the statements and the appearances that are here, the sources and so on. So I think we should. I think we should take our few tales from the content raised by the responsible, but I think it's a very concern. What happened? What happened to us? Why are we caught up in this? Okay. What does this mean about the state of Pakistan? Yes, we can understand what does it mean about the state of Pakistan in his life. Because also in this written report there are issues about how the doctors, you know, for health and human make decision that was supposed to be taken from one or not taken and so on. We must begin to ask questions around that. I mean, really, these are democratic issues in the democratic system. And if they fall short in one form or the other, I think it is the duty of ourselves, the policy makers, to be concerned about them, to then deal with it. And, you know, look at how we correct it, because it is the most important thing. But also, you know, the statement made in 2012 by Minister Hadley, the police president, addressing the senior management just the NP. And they say, but international law, South Africa is part of the international law. But international law has been law, and therefore there is a need to therefore investigate further on some of these things. I think it was up to the people. So we should have taken a few things. But I'm still saying now in the context of this portfolio committee, I think Mr. Fala has got the quite a valid point in terms of the, you know, establishing what is it that motivated and it motivates us to find ourselves in the positions or in a set of allegations that were not based on the example. There's something that you said, Mr. Colorbaum, that's why I said this is very important. The climate intelligence in the report is cited as the first people who were almost on the spot of time and conducted investigations. But then, I think I'm putting it to Mufango. Yes. Mufango is then instructed to disengage in favor of working together with NPD and NPD taking the lead, taking over the investigation. So the investigation does not have to be originated in time. But essentially, I think we need also to be appreciative of the cooperation that we got from the NPA in terms of assigning the officials to work with our people in the investigation as educated of this particular issue. Yeah. So thank you very much.
Otherwise, this is 10 minutes ago, before the plenary, the start of the block, so really this is a very urgent matter that you can raise it. Otherwise, Honourable Mabija, Honourable Bele, and Honourable Colabana. That's the subject.
Besides, what I'd like to indicate is that I should thank Honourable Labana to be aware that the work was called for them to the ministry. Because I read a copy to the ministry and she responded that it's natural there. Natural that to me can still be investigated. That's why I was asking the ministry, I'm there in any way planning to investigate the cause of death. Because it can be written natural, whereas it is not natural death. That was my question. So please let not cross the bridge before we come to this.
Thank you, Chairperson, for inviting me. I just have two quick questions. Well, it's one of my questions was partly answered, but not fully answered from the last round, where I'd asked the first report. I'd asked if the first report was signed by the acting director at the time. The minister did say that the first report was signed by the chief investigator, but that didn't shed any light as to whether the acting director. But I'm just trying to get to an understanding of why the first director, the first reports could not be signed by the acting director if that was the case, and only the chief investigator. The second one was then signed by the newly appointed director, and what that means in terms of procedural compliance and that sort of thing. I'm trying to get clarity on that. And then the second follow-up is if the minister could turn to page 54 of the report. It's section 5.1. Okay, I don't know. It's a 5.1.3.2.3.5.5. The report says, considering that McBride, in his capacity as executive director, is in the center of the rendition investigation. That's what I was asking about. And I was trying to understand what that means, what the premise is, and where it's going. Thank you.
Yeah, Chair, most of my questions have just been ignored, so I understand that. But I would at least like one answer, which is what has exercise cost? What is the check you're writing to Wake, Lung, Workman for the report? Because that's actually what taxpayers are paying. I'd like to know, because you've got plenty of lawyers here that you could have used.
Thank you very much, Minister. Minister, over
to you. Thank you very much. Let's start with the first second, I don't have the feeling. This report came out just a week ago, so I think
the no quote.
Yeah, this report came out a week ago.
No quote.
Now the this question, I mean the tectonic that is being referred here is the investigation, not the dynamic. Because A already spoke about the report says that you can apply to the center of not the dynamic, which is an act. So now the act in this particular case, not the dynamic, is the investigation that takes the dynamic. So in that instance, the executive director is ahead of this. So certainly that offended us. By the way, he's going to understand a number of allegations that have been made, for instance, in terms of what happened to the first and the second report, and so on. You know, so then you can't speak to Mr. Kuba with the investigation of Kuba without him, Mr. Kuba, in response. Respond to you know, the thanking the instructions from the government to some of the provided as well. So that was sent by the public, which says so the point of emphasis is investigation. So that's why it's but relation is something else. Now what was the first one?
Being Buza Uchi or the Kin, let me see.
So if you see the two copies for the website, I mean the one report is signed by the first one. The second so-called second report is signed by Hoover, so and right. Okay. Now I can't present, she can tell you what is the best, for instance, made
the acting director before Mr. Brian came and not signed the first and the fourth report. Was his support to sign? I mean, this has to be the difference. But was his support to sign and what is it? However, you know, and whether or not that is a material breach of any sort and so forth, you know, I think it's something that one still would have to look in. Safe to say that in the first report, you had two officers from the NP working on this. Even though it's also clearly stated that their group was not to take a decision whether to put it on. So I do suspect though that in the conduct in the work that continues around this particular some of you require some sort of particular that we would say to have a it's possible that even in the long run may have put it's not a matter that you have to look into specifically, so I think larger area of two operations and so on, in addition to what happened, how it happened, and of course the reason is that it's the one but you know, such a case such as the Magdalena and support and maybe others, I do not know the name I'm not too sure that this thing is doing because it really depends on what is going to come out or better at the nexus, be it disciplinary, you know, the giving or hearing and all for that matter to that person. The only thing that I hope to say just by on looking at the matter is that I really do hope that Athens of the Institute and the South Carolina, we never have it what the contrary of the situation is just saying. Never have it. I'm feeling very happy that we just, I mean, given the reputation that this country has bought, especially in terms of our, you know, effort and aspiration to create a human society and we to be like very kind of that strategy of the country, I think it is continuous and therefore the incidences of this population, allegations of this population, we don't actually find ourselves that we need to. And I think a second point is also the fact that we couldn't forget the history of some of these kinds of activities. And actually also perpetuated in certain instances in our name, the sort of children that we have about this problem. So this kind of understanding is one of the situation where we all get to a situation where that is the solution. I would really want to be, this is the end of the solution. Yeah, I think it's one of the fundamental
thank you very much, Minister. Thank you very much, members. I think we have proven today that the constitutional democracy is alive and well in South Africa. What we've also seen is that the oversight by the portfolio committee and also response by the executive. That's very important. If there is topical important issues, it's vital for the executive to come to Parliament, and we also saw that system. I think it's very positive to say it's a good example for other committees in Parliament. I think we take note of the input and the report. I think we welcome the approach that we should. There will be proper processes, there will be proper investigations in terms of discipline and NPA, and that there will be transparency. We welcome that as a committee. There must be stability in the oversight fraternity. The consensus that was indicated this morning about the NPA and processes during the last 2-3 years. That is really concerned.
investigation matter that the Portfolio Committee on Justice will have to look at. That's not in our domain. But thank you very much. We will monitor this process and we'll await the further outcome of the disciplinary and legal process. And thank you, Minister, for coming to the committee. Thank you, Minister.
What relationship, if any, between the sustainability and the minister? What relationship, if any, is there between the sustainability and the minister?
I don't know who's
on there. No idea. It would be worthwhile for someone who is just the guy who finds it off on it. And he's very
qualified.
Okay, I mean, this is a report of the news.